rest of it.
All right, call to order the meeting of the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Happy Monday, everyone. It is Monday, December 10th. We're going to get started. We don't have a quorum yet, but we can begin, and other members will be floating in now that they hear us beginning to talk. So we've got a full agenda today, so we're going to jump right in. I know that Paul Mather is here from ODOT, so I invite him to come on forward and bring anyone else you need to bring. One of the things we focused on this interim is really making sure that we've got regular reports in from ODOT about how projects that the legislature has funded in the last few years are going. What are the I've been very pleased that the reports have been just overwhelmingly, you know, projects on time, on budget, or sometimes even early under budget. And a lot of good construction prices out there, a lot of good job impacts, and a lot of good improved transportation opportunities. So we appreciate you coming back for the last opportunity this interim. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. Good morning. I'm going to go through a few of the projects. We didn't have the PowerPoint up. I'm just going to walk through a couple of the projects. But really what I want to get to towards the end is what we're calling our Jobs and Transportation, or JTA reallocation report that came to you, and kind of getting ready for the session of a bill that we need to move some of those funds around and what our commission's recommendations are. But I thought before we get to that, I'd get you just a few highlights on some of our projects. I know the chair is very familiar with this project, the Sunrise Corridor. We're very excited about this project moving forward. We're set to open bids on this project in March, so we're just a few months away from that, and we expect construction, obviously, this summer and the following summer to complete what's been a long process to get at least the first phase of the Sunrise Corridor complete. And obviously there'll be a number of benefits for this project, for the industries and businesses in that area. Ultimately, the project is designed to go further to the east out towards Rock Creek, but this first phase will be a critical piece, kind of bypassing the Clackamas area. Another project coming up for us.
Paul, could you actually just go back to that previous slide? I just wanted to point out to my colleagues, this is a very unusual map you'll see here, because the pieces that are in blue are actually completely new road construction. We don't see many maps like that have completely new road construction. That's going to make a huge difference in terms of accessing existing and potential industrial lands there.
And ultimately, we expect that blue line to be a four-lane roadway, but yep. With the funds available, we're going to build a two-lane alignment in there. Then the red and the green are local improvements to help support that new alignment that that project will have.
Thank you. Thanks. Sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
Good. Shute Road, or the Brookwood Helvetia Road interchange out on Sunset Highway in Washington County, is a key connector to industrial or high-tech industries out in that area. As that area continues to grow, the Sunset Highway and this interchange are needed to support that growth. We're in the process of completing design and right-of-way acquisition on this project for later on next year to open bids on interchange improvements there. That construction will be happening next fall, next winter, and hopefully completed through the following summer of 14 and ready to open to traffic. Another project that's been worked on for a long time is the Newburgh-Dundee project. It's a Jobs and Transportation funded project, along with other funds that we have in our STIP and federal dollars. This project originally was envisioned the environmental document was a much larger project. You'll see in the upper map there showing the full extent of the project, but the phase that we're going to build there in blue is with the money that's available from Jobs and Transportation Act and what we have in our STIP program for the project. This work on this project will start later on next year. It's a very large project, over $200 million. We've divided up into four different contracts and four different phases, partly just from the stageability of the work, but also to allow smaller contracts, more competition, hopefully more Oregon firms be able to bid on the work. But that work will begin next summer. We'll go through 2016 before it's complete. Like the chair pointed out on the Sunrise Corridor, this too is a new alignment that will bypass essentially the Newburgh-Dundee area of the project, and the community has long wanted this improvement. Another interchange project further south in the Medford area is the Fern Valley project. This too, like a lot of these large jobs and transportation projects, will be going to bid this next year. Construction will start next fall, and will take two summers to complete. The design on this interchange remodel is a little unique, and so we'll be doing some outreach and some education locally as to how to operate or navigate through this type of interchange. But the advantage of this type of interchange is the footprint that it has. It's a much smaller footprint than our typical designs that you've seen so far with the loop ramps and so forth. We're able to handle fairly large amounts of traffic in a very compact interchange. It minimizes right-of-way costs, but also just continues to have those lands around the interchange available for development. During the last decade, I think as the chair pointed out at the beginning, we've had an unprecedented amount of work going on in the transportation system. We've had the OTA-1, OTA-2, OTA-3, the Jobs and Transportation Act. We've had the stimulus money from the federal government. We've had literally hundreds and hundreds of projects that ODOT has delivered. When you total those projects together and you look at the budgets for all those projects, we are in an aggregate about 1% under budget when you put all those projects together. 90% of those projects have been delivered to construction on or ahead of schedule, and over 70% of those projects have been completed on time. And so that's a track record I think as a department we're very proud of, given the just the pressures of delivering such a large program that we have. This project, however, the Pioneer Mountain Dadyville project, continues to be an outlier in that process. We continue to struggle with this project, both technically and financially, as we try to move this project forward. When I was here last, I talked about how we have parted ways with the YRC or the contractor, design-build contractor that was working on this project. We had reached an agreement on a settlement to have ODOT take the project back over, and we began work this summer on aggressively working to dewater or drain the slides in the area and help stabilize the fill sections of the project, anticipation of a larger project to be let coming this summer. The one piece that we discovered as we were working through the project this last summer was not just the fills of the area, but the cuts of the area. So this is a photograph of one of the cuts and some of the rock failure that we've seen on the cut. This actually was not a surprise to us. This is actually a picture of kind of what we expected. We had rock raveling off here and there that we had to stabilize. What we found as we did extensive instrumentation of these cuts is that it's not just rocks, as you see in this picture, kind of raveling off. There's failures clear back literally at the top of the mountain where the whole hillside potentially could come down on the roadway. And for us to stabilize that slope was going to be significantly more work than we expected. And so when I was here last spring, I was talking about a figure of about $90 million that we needed to complete this project. But as we were completing our design and getting ready for construction and the work that was going to take to stabilize these cut fills that we were not anticipated, that number is about double what we thought it was going to be. More like $180 million that we need to complete the project. We are preparing to bring a presentation to our Transportation Commission next week, giving them about five different options of what we can do to proceed, ranging from moving ahead, completing the design as anticipated with those increased costs that I said, to an extremely scaled back version of the project, and we'll be having that discussion with our commission and looking for their direction on how to move forward. But this is a challenging project and continues to be, from a cost standpoint and just a management standpoint, have an outlier in our overall program management. Moving on, I want to touch on a couple other projects, Woodburn and the project in Eugene Springfield, I-5 Beltline. These two projects are, I'm going to kind of transition into what I talked about earlier in the jobs and transportation reallocation. These two are going to be central to our discussion in the next session about reallocating some additional funds. The Woodburn Interchange, obviously a congestion point on I-5, I think we've all probably experienced. We have a project that's going to be ready to go to bid with jobs and transportation funds this spring, opening a bid opening date in May. I think it's May 23rd is when we're anticipating going to construction. This project, when it was originally conceived in the Jobs and Transportation Act, like a lot of the larger projects, we were anticipating federal earmarks to supplement or to match the investment made in the Jobs and Transportation Act. Those earmarks have not come through the federal process. In each of those other projects, we've been able to scale back the design and kind of live or scale the project back to within the amount of dollars that we have. The one exception to that has been the Woodburn project. We haven't been able to scale the project back and still meet the project goals like we have in the other projects. And we're about $10 million short with this project. And so we're looking in the Jobs and Transportation Reallocation Bill to fill that hole. To move the project forward. One of the caveats, or just further information, to keep this project on track for construction this summer, we'll need that bill to happen relatively early in the session by March to keep the bidding process on track to have the project open or open bids in May so we can have construction start this summer. The flip side to that, or we have some additional savings that we'd like to transfer about $10 million from, is the Beltline project on I-5. You've seen this slide before. One of my previous presentations, I talked about another provision of the Jobs and Transportation Act, which was practical design. We applied those principles to this project. The design on the left, you'll see, was the original design that the original estimate was based on. The design on the right is what we're proposing moving forward with. You take a quick glance at that, it's kind of hard to tell what the differences are, which really tells you that we are meeting the goals and objectives of what we're trying to do in the project, but the way we've redesigned it, we've been able to save significant amount of money, and we're confident that we have enough funds to fully meet the objectives of this project as well as transfer funds to Woodburn to cover those costs. What we've done, if you want to just look closely, it's that off-ramp that as you're coming south on I-5 and you're wanting to go out on the Beltline. In the previous design, it was a much larger structure that came up and matched the flyover ramp that's there today. In the new design, it actually goes underneath of that, saving the structure costs, moving in the right-of-way footprint. The loop ramp you see in the center of that, you'll notice a slight difference in that one as well. It's actually a little tighter loop ramp. So just by shaving down the speeds in these off-ramps rather than trying to design, for example, to a 60 or 70 mile an hour design, going to a 45 or 50 mile an hour design, we're able to save significant amount of money that we're able to move and complete a different project. So those are the two highlights of the reallocation funds. If you look at my testimony, you'll see the other two projects. They're really kind of, I would describe as kind of housekeeping for Baker County. As you remember in the bill, there were specific dollar amounts allocated to some of the Eastern Oregon counties. There was a couple projects that Baker County had some savings on that they wanted to move to a different Jobs and Transportation Act project, and so it'll be, again, what I would describe as kind of housekeeping to be able to allow Baker County to move some funds from one of their JT projects to another. So that's just a quick overview of some of the major projects and what you'll see upcoming in the jobs JTA reallocation. There is, you'll see in my testimony, there is a legislative concept that will be in the next session and trying to move, again, quickly with that Jobs and Transportation Act reallocation funds in March so we are able to keep the Woodburn project on track will be important for us to do. You'll see a website in there for all the projects, and also in my testimony, you'll see a list of all the Jobs and Transportation Act projects if you're curious about where their status is. Also, and I failed to point out as I went through the Woodburn project, there's a nifty little video that we put together kind of describing what the Woodburn interchange and what the staging of construction is going to be. So if you're interested, you're able to go online and check that little video we put out for the public to kind of see or envision what the stages of that construction on Woodburn's going to look like. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Questions for Paul?
So each of these is viewed as sort of part of a continuum of things we're going to continue to do as a state. What's the easiest place for folks who are here and folks who are at home to find out and understand better what the next stages are, right, of the various interchanges need to get done, the various corridors that we're working on? You know, what's the best way to understand sort of future plans, what future capital needs are going to be, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, if you're looking at the Jobs and Transportation Act project, many of those, like Sunrise and Newport, mm-hmm. Newburgh-Dundee, there's other phases to those projects yet to come. We have standalone websites for each of those. If you go into our Jobs and Transportation Act website, you'll be able to see those project names, and typically we have a link over to those project websites you'll be able to go forward with. If you're looking for projects beyond or needs beyond what's in contacting our region offices. On our web pages, again, we'll have some of that planning information, but typically if you're interested in a very specific interchange or a very specific section of road, we may not have that information on our website. But typically the community, whether it's a city or a county, along with our staff, have been working together through our various planning processes. We'll either have in the transportation system plan for the specific community, will be listed in there for future plans, or in one of our corridor studies or corridor plans that we may have. So I direct you to one of our five regional offices for our planning staff will be able to help you.
So I call somebody. Strategic plan that you guys are working off of? I know things change because legislature comes and does stuff, but is a strategic plan you guys are working off of that says how we're going to spend our next $1 billion, how we're going to spend our next $250 million, how we're going to spend our next $3 billion?
Representative Smith, not that specifically. What we do have is a transportation plan, and we have our modal plans, highway plan, transit plans. Those provide us the policy direction from our transportation commission. We use those policy directions to shape our project selection processes. As you may know, we have area commissions on transportation around the state made up of city, county, private business people. They help direct us in selecting those projects. So we have, I would describe, policy documents kind of at that high level, then we have specific planning documents in a corridor within a community, and then from those we have these area commissions on transportation selecting projects given where we have opportunities, whether it's the kind of stream of federal money that's coming through us now through MAP 21, or whether discussions like we had with the Jobs and Transportation Act where the legislature specifically prescribed a list of projects.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. So I think I heard you say was the transportation plan documents are sort of are humanities documents. They're not math. They're like, it'd be nice if we could do these following things. And then for each sort of granular choice you've already made or working on making, we have numbers attached. But there isn't anything sort of in between that says we're going to try to hit that and that's going to cost between this and that. We're going to try to hit that and that's going to cost between this and that. That we have sort of goals and strategies, but in terms of numerical objectives or kind of that middle step, it's less clear. Am I hearing that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative, just one clarification I'd make is that in those policy documents, there is some conversation about limiting from a financial standpoint of our policy or the cost of those policies are going to have. So there are scenarios that we've run in developing the transportation plan or in the highway plan, some assumptions of what a general overall revenue could look like or were to be assumed to look like over the planning 20-year planning horizon of the document. So there is some mm-hmm. financial constraints put on that planning process. It's not quite open as you described, but it's not far from what you described either.
Okay. And I know we're talking about infrastructure exchange later. And part of what I'm wanting to get a sense of is how we can, with changing funding and budget environments, how we can get a handle on, you know, what capital needs and building needs are going to be out, you know, the next 5-10 years, and how do we estimate those? What are the ranges, and what are the policy choices that we might make now or might not make that would shape those things and what those levers are? And if there's, other than calling a regional office, if there's anything you'd want to point me or sort of the successor who will sit in my chair later, that would be great.
Good. Yeah.
Is there anything?
I don't. I'd have to go back and look at our information, what we have on the web, to be able to tell you exactly what's out there. I know we have some information out there. Okay. What I do know is if you talk to one of our planners in a regional office, they'll be able to point you to those areas.
Thanks a lot.
Other questions for Paul? Again, really appreciate the updates and all the great work that ODOT is doing. I would note on wood-burning exchange, and you may have said this, but the reason there's a gap in the reason there's a need for additional dollars in the wood-burning exchange is not because of any bad cost estimates early on. It's just we misguessed. When we did the JTA, we on each project, we had to guess how much we thought the federal government would come up with for various projects. And we actually guessed fairly well on the vast majority of them. We misguessed on that one, and they just haven't stepped up to the degree that we had anticipated. So
that's exactly right.
I think the cost estimate for that project is pretty much exactly where it was when the JTA
passed. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd have to go back and look it up, but if it's not the same, it's very close to the same. Really, the gap is driven by that not having the federal earmarks that we assumed when we put the 2009 Job Stratification Act together.
Yeah. Good. Keep good work. Thanks for being here. So next we're going to move on to, you'll see the first four topics we've got, colleagues, are kind of on four separate issues, but I'd invite Gary Neal and Mark Landauer to come forward. This is a new proposal they're going to share with us that the Oregon Public Ports Association is bringing in to the 2013 session that is intended to help make the legislature's job easier, right?
Yes.
Sure.
Welcome.
Guess I'll start here, get my...
If you just introduce yourself for the record to begin.
Okay, thank you. Find my notes here first, I guess. Co-chairs Hunt and Vance, members of the committee, my name is Gary Neal. I'm the general manager of the Port of Marl and the president of the Oregon Public Ports Association. I've been a manager at the Port of Marl since 1989, and if you're not familiar with the Port of Marl, we have a substantial land base and terminal operations on the eastern part of the Columbia River, about 165 miles east of Portland. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear here today and discuss a process and funding proposal the OPPA has been working on for some time, and we're finally in a position to begin discussing it with a larger audience such as yourselves. There are 23 ports in the state of Oregon. Those ports span east on the Columbia River clear to the Port of Umatilla and to Brookings Harbor on the south part of our Oregon coastline. There's 15 ports along the coastline, and there's 8 ports east of Astoria on the Columbia River. We provide industrial and commercial lands to large and small companies and own and operate RV parks and marinas, docks, recreational commercial fishermen use these facilities, and we have rail, air, and marine infrastructure for transportation of people, bulk, and containerized cargo as well. We're very diverse throughout the state. Each one of our ports have their own area of expertise and assistance in those economies. We share a desire to see one another succeed, but we're also competitors with each other. And we communicate on a regular basis, and we share expertise and advice to help each other in those efforts. And our revenues that are generated by ports are fairly diverse. They include lease lands and buildings, terminal-related activities. We have a small portion of our revenues that are associated with property tax revenues. We're also permitted to seek financing programs through bonding and loan programs that we're eligible to pursue as well. And we apply for and from time to time are successful in receiving federal and state funds in the form of grants or loans when they're appropriate. We have a major impact on local economies and regional economies and state economies as well. An example, you know, the Port of Portland is our largest port, as you know, and they generate approximately 41,000 direct jobs through the harbor and aviation-related activities, and their $3.5 billion of direct and induced wages and salaries, and they supply about in excess of $300 million of state and local taxes. So that's an example of one of our larger ports, or our largest, by the way. According to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department, the Oregon commercial fishing industry, which has a major impact on our coastal ports, supplies about $500 million worth of income to the economy of the state as well. Port of Mall in eastern Oregon, we supply in excess of 6,000 to 8,000 jobs and about $1 billion a year in economic impact to our local economy. And now those were 2006 statistics, and we're now updating those economic analysis. We think we've probably more than doubled that in the last 6 years. In cooperation with the Oregon Business Development Department, the Ports Association and all the ports are preparing an economic impact analysis to be able to share that information and collectively submit that as a better information for how it affects the state and local economies of our region. I think, you know, as it relates to ports, I mentioned the example of the Port of Portland, but, you know, all ports have a major impact on their local economies, and I think it's all relative to the size of the area we represent. The ability of our ports to remain viable centers of commerce and recreation is dependent upon port facilities being attractive, efficient, and updated in meeting our user needs. When port facilities are well maintained and modernized, the ability of existing employers to retain jobs and expand are enhanced, and furthermore, the port's ability to attract new business increases as well. But in order for ports to maintain a competitive position and be a catalyst for economic activity and growth, you know, access to capital, particularly for small and medium-sized ports, remains a challenge. You talk about the need for economic benefits and creation of jobs. Infrastructure is one of the key components of being able to create those jobs. Oregon ports have limited access to capital that makes a difference between retaining existing jobs or expanding operations or attracting new employers to one of our public ports in this state. And we're competing with other states and other regions throughout the country as well. Ports can creatively pull together financing packages for to assist in those projects, but quite often there's a gap that was funding that either delays or prevents those projects from happening when they are needed the most. As a result, last year, Oregon Ports Association solicited a list of shovel-ready projects, and I remember having a conversation with Representative Hunt about this effort, and we received those projects from our member ports and to get a sense of the types of projects that ports had identified in their capital facilities plans. And so shovel-ready meant that the permits would be in hand within 6 months, because we tried to define what that meant on shovel-ready. And construction could begin within, say, 240 days of if the funds were in hand. And so we tried to put some sideboards on what those shovel-ready opportunities might be. We wanted to get a sense of how many jobs that would be retained or created by these projects, and how much money was being provided by the port itself, and what other funds had been secured for the projects that we put together. And each port was eligible to submit a project, and it was going to be their priority from a list of many projects in their capital improvement plans. On the solicitation that met the criteria we're looking for, we received the list of 8 projects. And It showed us that there are a number of projects that are in need of gap funding in order to begin turning dirt. And those projects had measurable impacts on retaining and creating new jobs. The challenge, of course, was to identify a new source of funding, which is always easy to do. I mean, always not easy to do. Furthermore, another challenge was whether we as individual ports could coalesce around a process by which every port would be eligible to access capital, but only if their project resulted in a tangible job creation and retention. And to date, I'm happy to report that there's 18 of our 22 members. The 23rd member of the Port of Portland is not part of this particular process. Supporting the process of to solicit, evaluate, and recommend port-related infrastructure projects for funding. And we expect the remaining four ports will be formally endorsing this process by the end of the year. Each of the other 18 ports to date have passed resolutions at their commission level to get behind this effort. And I guess at this point, I would like to go ahead and turn it over to Mark for further discussion, unless you have other questions at this time.
We'll take questions for both of you. Go ahead, Mark.
Very good. Good morning, Co-Chairs Hunt and Bentz. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association. And I want to thank you for your interest in the work that we've been doing for a good year now on pulling together a proposal to provide, as Mr. Neal described, sort of a gap funding instrument that will allow ports to further enhance their ability to attract new employers and create family wage jobs in the state of Oregon. As Mr. Neal pointed out, the success of our ports is largely dependent on their facilities being well-maintained, modern, and up-to-date. Furthermore, as Gary pointed out, the availability of funding to address these capital projects is somewhat limited, and as a result, we wanted to really get a sense for the types of projects that were contained in each port's capital facilities plan, and really get a good sense for what those projects, A, were, and B, what the impact of those projects would have on the local community. I often like to use an example where a project at the Port of Portland that will attract 200 jobs will get front page headlines in the Oregonian, whereas if a five-job project at the Port of Bandon, if you will, never sees any ink whatsoever. But the important point is that the impacts of those five jobs in that area around Bandon is largely the same that the 200 jobs would be in the city of Portland just because of the population base. And so we really wanted to get a better understanding of the economic impacts that ports have around the state. And as Mr. Neal has mentioned, we are in the process of doing individual economic impact statements, not only for the individual ports, but also their impacts regionally and collectively as a state. We haven't done that. It's something that we're very interested in getting, and as Mr. Neal mentioned, some of those statistics are really quite eye-opening. So, to back up a bit, we have been told for quite some time that in order for ports to access a funding system, if you will, that we ought to collectively get together and follow what many have termed as the community college model. And that is all the community colleges at this time get together, identify various projects, sit in a room, and basically prioritize those projects for funding. And every biennium, as you know, the legislature provides capital funding to the community colleges. Well, as a result of those admonitions from various legislators over the years, we decided to actually undertake this process. And I'm here to report that our first effort to do this was actually quite eye-opening. Some of the projects that were submitted actually competed very well under the Connect for process. In fact, two of those projects that were submitted to us were submitted to us prior to Connect awarding. One was a complete rebuild of the wharf at the Port of Garibaldi. The other one was completing a major project at the Port of Newport. Nevertheless, we still have a number of projects that have very meritorious outcomes that we believe will have a substantial impact on the local economies and the ability of those ports to retain and, frankly, grow family wage jobs in their areas. So I'd like to just briefly go through the process by which we would like to evaluate various projects that are submitted, and I'll tell you that we are in the process of soliciting a whole new round of projects expect to have a list again this year. One point that I'd like to really underscore that I think is largely the take-home issue is that the ports have historically gone on their own as individuals to the legislature seeking funding. What's unique about this is that this is a consensus effort, whereby some ports' projects would not necessarily get funding, but what they would do is support the other ports in their efforts, with the hope that if this pilot project, if you will, proves to be beneficial, that at some point one of their projects in the future, if it meets the criteria and the desired outcomes, would get funding at some future date. So we as a organization have coalesced around this process and have agreed that there won't be any lobbying on behalf of their own particular project if it doesn't make the list. Rather, they will be supporting the entire package in the future, with the hope, of course, that they will have a good project in the future. Some of the factors that we have really placed on submitting a project for consideration and ranking are, as Gary had mentioned previously, that the project is contained in the port's capital improvement plan, that significant weight will be given to those projects that will demonstrate that they will either retain existing jobs or expand permanent jobs. Of course, another factor that will be weighed less is the temporary construction jobs that would be involved with the project, but we're really focusing or trying to focus in on the retention of existing and expansion of new jobs. As Gary mentioned also, permits need to be in hand within 6 months. Construction would occur within 240 days upon receipt of the funding. And that the project, the funding that you're seeking under this project will complete a program or a project or is a logical phase of a larger project and will complete that phase. Many of the larger projects across the state, I think Newport is a good example, where they were building a new dock, if you will, was a phased project, and they had used some existing ships to to build that dock upon. There was a great deal of remediation that had to be conducted. Ultimately, that project is nearing completion, but there were many phases in that rather large $25 million project.
Mark, if you could,
yes, sir.
You could try to wrap it up.
Yep. In any event, I think the takeaway here is that the Oregon Business Development Department had submitted this as a policy option package. The governor did not include this in his budget. We are hoping that we will work with the legislature in order to try to gain access to a small amount of special public works funds in order to test whether or not this proposal, in fact, merits further consideration. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today and happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions?
Thank you very much.
I would just one note of caution based on the community college experience. I think the key to the community college success was that they really did all do what you described as really stick together once they came up with the list. I can think of one example where one community college started to go rogue probably in about 2005, and it almost shattered the whole thing, but they were able to come back on board, and they've gone from, I think, zero funding for community colleges over a course of about almost 30 years to couple hundred million dollars over the last 8 years.
Yes.
So it really is a very successful model, but it's hard to keep, in their case 17, in your case 23, separate competing, as Gary said, entities all on the same page. But the success of that is clearly demonstrated. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure that your use of rogue was just merely a coincidence in that sentence.
Correct.
But I also just indicate, second your comments, the Oregon Innovation Council has had a similar experience as far as different groups sticking together for success. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. So still in the theme of infrastructure, but moving on to another proposal, I invite Tom and Mike to come forward. You've heard a little bit about, but we'll get a chance to hear more about today, the proposed infrastructure exchange program, which is very exciting, innovative as well. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us, Co-Chairs Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz. For the record, my name is Tom Reinhart. I'm Chief of Staff for State Treasurer Ted Wheeler, and one of the committee members originally charged with developing the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. I was before you a number of months ago to tell you about the nascent effort. And today I'm going to update you on where we're at, tell you a couple stories, tell you where we want to go, and answer any questions. You may remember that about a year ago we started an effort with California and Washington just to explore what we could potentially do on the unmet $1 trillion of estimated infrastructure investment that the American Society of Civil Engineers says we need on the West Coast in the next 20 years. Conversations among the states moved towards more questions and more questions and more questions about the role of private investment, what we could do across state lines or not, and we decided we should pursue grant money to see what the feasibility of actually working together was. The Rockefeller Foundation invested $250,000 in December of last year. We funded a consultant report by CH2M Hill with that money that charted out some things that we could do together. That report is online at westcoastx.com is the internet site that our effort is described in. So for those of you with computers, you may want to look at that now. And what we've done with that report is engaged now British Columbia, Washington, California, and partners here in Oregon, the governor and the treasurer's office working together to look at what it tells us we may be able to do with creating vehicles for private investment potentially, creating committees to look specifically up and down the West Coast at water and energy in particular, where we know a lot about unmet need but not enough about shared needs and shared timelines on projects. And we have money now, an additional $500,000 from the same foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, to hire an exchange manager over the next year to help us build an initial organization. We have an agreement among these four entities, the three states on the West Coast and the province of British Columbia, to work together for at least a year in the following manner. figure out a business case scenario list that will help us not just provide guidance to states, but also to local communities on what some new and innovative forms of infrastructure investment are that are being used in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. And in fact, the private investors that we work with through the pension fund have told us for years that the United Kingdom, Australia, other parts of the world are way ahead of us on working with the private sector to make infrastructure investment much more efficient, project management much more efficient, cost-effective for taxpayers. And we want to at least create a center for best practices on the West Coast so that communities across Oregon have access to information about how to do infrastructure more efficiently and smarter. The other committees will focus on energy and water. As I probably don't have to tell you that many of you are in districts, represent districts, where there's a huge unmet need for sewage treatment, for all sorts of water infrastructure. We were surprised to know that our lists are not very good on the West Coast about what projects are even out there and what needs to be done. So in a nutshell, what we've done is kicked off another year of this collaboration. In mid-November, Governor Kitzhaber, Treasurer Wheeler, California Treasurer Bill Lockyer, representatives of the Ministry of Finance and Infrastructure from British Columbia, and the Department of Commerce in Washington gathered in San Francisco to launch this effort, celebrate the grant money, and chart the course for the committees. I expect to be before you with colleagues over the next year to give you more specific updates on what the committees are recommending, what, if any, legislation we may need over the next couple of years to help out. We anticipate that there may be tweaks to statute we might need to make the infrastructure exchange effective for local governments and local communities. One quick story before I take questions. For me, a lot of this is founded on a conversation I had when I first came to Treasury with Treasurer Wheeler, with one of the largest private infrastructure investors in the world. And he had come to pitch Oregon on investment. I asked him, how come groups like yours that invest billions of dollars in airports and seaports and rail spurs and all sorts of infrastructure don't invest in the United States? And he looked at me and said, it's not worth an hour of my junior analyst's time to work with local governments in the United States. I pushed him a little bit and he said, people don't understand working with the private sector. They don't have legal templates. They don't have documents and experience in this. It's much more efficient for us to put our capital to use in other parts of the world. So what it told me was, whether or not that's an avenue that we go down in Oregon, a road that we go down, we should be much more knowledgeable about what other people are doing that are building much more infrastructure than we are and that are doing it more in a more cost-effective and efficient manner. So with that, I think I'll end and take questions. I hope that was a useful overview.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah. Either for questions, Mike, or do you have anything else to add?
Just for questions.
Questions for these gentlemen. Coach Urbanus.
Thank you. So the more cost-effective and efficient way, that's a nice phrase at the end. That seemed to be an assumption. Is that a correct assumption? More cost-effective and efficient, that's the idea, right? How do we know that would be the result of what you're suggesting?
Co-Chair Brents, Co-Chair Hunt, thanks for the question. I anticipated that you may ask this question, Co-Chair Brents, from previous experience. when I was a Treasurer Wheeler at Multnomah County, we had specific experiences in this with both the East County Courthouse and Selwood Bridge Project, which we helped lay the foundation for, which one is now constructed and one is under construction. What we found was, oftentimes public jurisdictions have a difficult time moving beyond the design, bid, build process and looking at, well, if we engage a different way of working with a general contractor where the whole contract was wrapped into one, that they had incentive to do the design, the construction, the ongoing maintenance all in one package. This is called performance-based contracting. This is done in many parts of the world, not so commonly done in the United States, although it's becoming more common. We have seen that this is the way that both public entities can do things on time and under budget, oftentimes before their timelines that they've anticipated. And it's often a way that the private sector can get more involved and do things that are more appropriate for the private sector, like project management, like taking the risk of the timelines and the operations and management in a way that the public sector hasn't been very good at. For example, owning and managing a building over 30 years, it's difficult with public budgets, different elected officials, and frankly, underpaid and not as well-trained local government staff to manage complex projects. And we found this in the most populous and very pretty well-staffed local government in the state in terms of Multnomah County, that we often didn't have people that could manage projects as well as the treasurer had seen in the private sector in terms of firms managing projects. So the idea of the exchange is, if we can have a place that actually can advise the government of Clackamas County or a local city, listen, if you have a project of this X size with these types of parameters, here's some options for you that other local governments have tried that have lowered the costs, made sure it's on time, shared the risk with the private sector. This is a way to actually help people that often don't have the same types of technical experience that a private firm would have or a larger government would have. Co-Chair Benz, I hope that was helpful for you.
Let's continue. Thank you. It is, and I would be extremely interested in seeing the evolution of the thought of the concept. It's really interesting. I think I'll just stop at that point and ask Great. Where I look. So Great. Go online. And
yes, we'll have case studies lined out as we build out our website, and the committee work will be up on the website as well, because what we anticipate is, even before we have any conversation of joint projects, we'll have best practices and models for smaller and local governments to use. We're not naive that state to state will be very difficult to do joint projects over the next year or two. Hopefully, long term, we'll get in a position where we may be able to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the explanation. I think it's a very exciting concept, and the idea that we may or may not need to take any legislative action in the next session. But are there, as you kind of continue the conversation, are there one or two or three things that you think that this committee and our successors ought to be thinking about as we come into the next session? Are there things you anticipate we would be better off having in mind as we go forward?
Co-chairs, Representative Reed, thank you for the question. I do believe that it would be wise for Treasury staff, Governor staff to be working with this committee in particular to look at, as we go down the road, the so-called public-private partnership model in the United States has been fraught with difficulty. Some of you may be aware of stories of toll roads and other things that have been, invested in via the private sector that haven't done as good a job at protecting the public trust in terms of making sure that the tax dollars were used wisely and that people weren't paying more over 30 years for a service than they should be. I do think we should be talking together about, Oregon has a very good public-private piece of legislation, I forget the numbers to refer to at this point or the specific part of code, but we have very, very good enabling legislation. I think we should be careful about how the state might go forward in any endeavor that mixes public and private money without having clear standards about how those investments would be made. Meaning, where does the state want to be on protecting public employment? Where does the state want to be on what interest rates for projects so that taxpayers can't justifiably say the state sold us down the river on this investment just to build something more quickly? So I do think those questions are important. I think other places in the country have learned the hard way because they just got excited, oh, we're going to build stuff more quickly. And boy, some private money might come in, so let's just build it. I think we should be much more thoughtful, and I hope the committee will be open and legislators will be open to working with us on that.
Thank you.
And if I may?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. As we go move forward on this project over the next session, I think that what my colleague said is correct. The current statute is already relatively broad and willing to accept, I think, this type of innovation. So I don't think we're going to see a huge, gigantic sea change bill of over 100 pages. We'll keep you updated with regards to any particular tweaks that we need. One thing that we do expect to bring forward next session is measure to the Ways and Means Committee that will enable us to spend this Rockefeller grant that is financing the work that we're doing up to this point on it, and hopefully in the future. And in addition, we do have a placeholder bill legislation that we filed for this session. So that's kind of in the chamber, so to speak, if you'll excuse the pun.
Representative Smith.
And I do, I mean, you know, on one hand, I find it really interesting. On one hand, there's pieces that make me real nervous. And that won't matter to you because, you know, I got a couple more weeks. But the, but I do hope that we'll at least keep a couple things firmly in sconce in our brain, which is, yeah, private money sounds great, but understand they're not giving it to us.
Exactly.
Right? They're going to own it. And it's a different thing to have public-private sort of partnership, sort of, or sort of something like the Port of Portland, which has a public mission and can make choices and can decide, you know what, we're gonna buy and develop on Hayden Island, and we're going to be in charge of industrial lands because we're going to keep the public thing in mind. We're making investment choices, and we're not going to sell it cheap early because it's a public good, and we're going to wait a little bit and make and sell it when it's really worth something and make the kind of choices that somebody with a nearer term outlook can't make. So I am, you know, with various friends in the room, let's say, like, we should be really, really careful about that. And I hope at least we'll consider two questions. One is, what is the what are revenue options beyond tolling? As we look at revenue options, for instance, we got really excited about the Betsy to build windmills, and all of a sudden that golden goose kind of got killed because we fed it too much. So what are the various ways we might be able to capture some of that revenue or preserve some of that revenue for the publicly interested elements of those projects? And then also, what are possible governance models? So that's one or two questions. And the other is, what are possible governance models so that we make sure that we're thinking about the public thing as we're making these decisions, right? If I'm maximizing profit for a road, all I want is Audis, right? Or I could imagine a model where all I want is Audis. So, but in making infrastructure choices, we got a lot of objectives beyond the capture of that profit. And I am hopeful that Nancy Nathanson will be taking on all of those issues in the coming sessions of the legislature, and that Tobias Reed and Cliff Bentz will listen to her.
We don't get to take them on.
Co-chair Hunt, Co-chair Bentz.
Right, but I just, you know, I'm putting my faith in Nancy at this point.
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, thank you for the question. We will take those questions into careful consideration and are taking them into consideration. I want to respond to your admonition about what we call in the collaborative, in this West Coast Exchange collaborative effort, the free money ferry. We do believe, yeah, and we've been telling you, there is no free money ferry. We're being very careful with people about it. We have seen that the difference in terms of, as all of us know, the economy's changed so much since 2008 that the so-called bogeyman of private sector individuals has changed very much. They actually want much less return than they used to for projects because
the economy's
stinks.
They're going to lose their money.
So it's not as bad as it used to be in terms of the risk of losing a lot of taxpayer money, but there's always that risk, and we have to be extremely careful, and we have to be diligent. And our partners in British Columbia have done the best job at this in terms of, they're way ahead in terms of what the province has done. I might have mentioned this when we presented previously to this committee. But what we've learned up there is they actually have an 80% public dollar to 20% private mix in any project that has any private money. So what they do is they preserve, they're the lion's share of it. They drive the deal. So the deal is always structured in terms of, well, we want this much in terms of how the work goes. We want the work governed in terms of building a bridge or whatever the project is in XYZ way. So they retain, you know, not just majority ownership, but 80% ownership. And I think that that's been a wise model for them in terms of taking care of what I think you are referring to in terms of the risks here.
Thanks.
Yep.
No other questions. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the update. We're going to move on to Derek and Susie, who are already coming up. They've been doing some great work with a whole bunch of public and private sector folks around our regional export strategy.
Jobs.
Welcome. Please Thank begin you. By introducing yourself for the record.
Good morning. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, for the record, I'm Derek Olson, with Vice President of Regional Strategy and Coordination for Greater Portland, Inc.
Co-Chair Hunt,
Co-Chair Bentz, good morning. I'm Susie Lassen, Senior Manager for Transportation and Land Use Policy for the Port of Portland.
You don't want to talk about Beltline and I-5?
No, thank you, Chair.
Is my head in the way?
Your hair is in the way.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benson, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak here to you before today. Again, my name is Derek Olson with Greater Portland, Inc. I'm going to just give a brief background on what Greater Portland, Inc. is and then go into the presentation on the Metro Export Initiative. I'll then pass the baton over to Susie, who will talk in more depth about transportation and exports. First of all, Greater Portland, Inc. is a public-private economic development nonprofit that represents the Portland metro area, and the metro area is defined by the federal metropolitan statistical area. So it's five counties in Oregon: Clackamas, Columbia, Multnomah, Washington, and Yamhill, and two is Clark and Skamania. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's similar to others throughout the state like EDCO, Soretti, SEDCOR, and Lane Metro. Our key focus is on business development, especially business retention and expansion and business recruitment. And it's through this lens that we approach the export initiative. And you may say, why are we focused on exports? And this is why. We have $21 billion in exports. This is the Portland region. And we're looking to double that in 5 years to 42. And if we do, it means jobs and revenue, because approximately $1 billion in extra additional exports equates to roughly 5,400 jobs. So if we were successful in what, for those of you who read Good to Great, I consider a big, hairy, audacious goal to double exports in 5 years, we would add approximately 113,000 jobs. That is the goal, and that is why exports are the focus and why we partnered with the Brookings Institution to be one of the four pilot areas in the country to attack this initiative. The idea is to try to do on a local level what's being done, challenged by the national level by President Obama, to double exports in 5 years. Four other cities that were chosen are LA, Syracuse, Minneapolis, St. Paul, so we're in good company, and there are now eight additional cities, including Charlotte, Chicago, and others that are following our lead. Many of you might have heard of this in the spring, and passed around is the export plan that was at a big launch event in the spring with the Brookings Institution. With a lot of study data and the general outlines of the plan. Since then, we've come together. I came on board from Business Oregon over to Greater Portland, Inc. to work specifically on this this initiative. We came together, a community, is to draft a business plan and have an interagency work team with public and private sector to transition to implementation of it. Over the summer, we detailed out a business plan for all our strategies, which I'll mention here in a minute. We, as you see, some of the key things we did this summer, bringing together in the process, including most especially the export leaders, which is a high-level, C-level group co-chaired by Tom Hughes, Metro Council President, and Jill Island of Intel, to be a public-private C-level, high-level board to oversee what we're doing. They kicked that off. For those of you who might have been at the Economic Summit in Portland that our organization hosted in September, they spoke about that. And then in the background, all the work groups are now diving into the implementation. And again, this is a strategy that has four parts that's trying to get at key things that we can do to move the dial on exports. It's done with the idea that we're not going to tackle things already being done by other areas. So if there's other organizations working on major transportation projects, or for instance, there's a heck of a lot of great work being done in agricultural exports already by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, those areas are not focused on in the strategy, because the idea was with limited time and resources, we would focus on things that were not being already tackled effectively. So these are the four that we chose, and I'll go into brief detail in a minute. They're leverage primary exporters, catalyze under exporters, build the export pipeline, and brand and market Greater Portland's global edge. I'm going to touch on what we're trying to do in this first year of the strategy and mention some of the partners that we're working with. So we're the convener, we're the quarterback, but we could not do this without great partners, public-private sector. Our first strategy is leverage primary exporters. This is based around the fact that approximately 60% of the exports in the region are computer and electronics. Some obvious key companies that are critical to that, like Intel, but there's a host of other smaller companies that are also just as integral to the supply chain. And so we decided that we needed a concentrated focus on this. We have a team led by John Southgate of the Greater Hillsborough Area Chamber of Commerce, pulling together economic development and trade professionals in the area, working closely with another group led by Karen Godden, Managing Director for Business Innovation and Trade for Business Oregon. And then along with my colleague here, Susie Lassen of the Port of Portland, who's going to present after me in more detail on transportation. The idea of these three aspects of the strategic, this strategic action is to get at what's going on with the computer and electronics industry. How do we analyze better what's in the supply chain and getting more companies locally into that supply chain or recruiting ones that are, don't exist locally, and then tackling some of the freight and logistics issues in transportation that these companies face. In the out years, we have further tasks we're trying to accompany, tackle through this, including looking at what kind of freight is leaking out. In other words, what could go out through the Port of Portland but is going out for other ports, and then integrating the work we do on supply chain further into the existing recruitment work done by the region to recruit in companies where we're not able to build up local companies to meet supply chain needs in the computer and electronics industry. The second major strategy we're implementing is catalyzing under exporters. It's focusing on getting better knowledge of key industry sectors and markets for our businesses, including especially our key industries. And in the Portland area, those are identified by the region as outdoor gear and apparel, high tech and software, clean technology, and advanced manufacturing. And so we're looking at those four. And then we're on a macro level. Then a micro level, we're working with our economic development partners, MBA programs, and others to provide more concentrated case management assistance to small and medium-sized companies who need help navigating the maze of export assistance out there to really make a difference and ramping up their exporters. In the out years, we will expand that to peer-to-peer mentoring for companies who are more experienced with that, mentoring smaller and medium-sized companies that are newer to this game. Third major strategy we have is called Build the Export Pipeline. There's two key components to this. One is we're working very closely with the Brookings Institution that's working with a private company that is hopeful, if the negotiations go successfully, create a website for all the pilot metros that will pull together all the different resources that are out there for exporting companies to make it very easy for companies to access those, to have a way to triage for intake, provide a LinkedIn type of discussion, event calendar, and other aspects to really have an export community in the metro area. And then we are working with our partners at Business Oregon and the U.S. Export Assistance Center, Small Business Development Center, and the Small Business Administration to provide economic development professionals training to help experts in cities and counties whose day-to-day job is probably more focused on things like industrial lands and workforce and others to integrate in their conversations with companies export assistance so they know how to help point small and medium-sized businesses to the right types of assistance, whether that's for market research or financing or others. And that's going to be done both on a regional level, but then it's going to be rolled out statewide through the Oregon Economic Development Association. And then finally, our last major strategy is on branding and marketing Greater Portland's Global Edge. This kicked off with a clean tech focus of the campaign called We Build Green Cities, which the Portland Development Commission took the lead on. And that is an excellent website, if you go to it, that has a Wieden and Kennedy video looking at how our strengths are marketable for making sales in goods and services overseas to cities that are looking to develop in a sustainable manner. This now is being replicated in our other key clusters, advanced manufacturing, outdoor gear and apparel, and computer and electronics, and help both to explain those industries when we talk to companies that are looking in this area to do business, and also help those companies as a base platform from which to launch export activities. In the out years, we will expand that to further internationalization of our marketing of the region, something that Greater Portland Inc. is very involved in. And those are the major four strategies. There's a ton of detail, a huge long business plan, but I wanted to bring you the big picture and just emphasize in closing before I pass to Susie that the idea here really is to tackle things, as I mentioned before, that were not effectively being done, to bring the private and public sectors together, to try to address issues that could make it easier for companies, the small, medium-sized companies to export, but also working in partnership with the larger companies who have some of the expertise, who have the supply chains the small, medium-sized companies need to get into, and can help us raise the visibility of this. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'll pass the floor now to Susie.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, committee members. Again, my name is Susie Lassen. I am Managed Transportation Land Use Policy for the Port of Portland. And the message here today really is related to the export strategy. The concept is that what we anticipate is that the developing nations internationally are going to grow faster and have more demand for manufactured products than we will domestically. And so making sure that our transportation system can perform for the export growth becomes critical. As Derek mentioned, Portland metropolitan exports are significant, representing about $21.3 billion in terms of volume and about 142,000 jobs. What that translates to is that we are ninth in the nation as a state in terms of export value to our gross state product, and statewide that means about 470,000 jobs related to international trade. It's significant because we have an average salary for those involved in trade and logistics jobs of significantly higher than the U.S. average. And as far as the Portland metropolitan area goes, our exports tend to be some services, but primarily products. I think this is also critical because it translates to the type of transportation system that becomes critical for growth in this particular area. The things that keep exporting businesses growing is that they are able to provide products and services to markets beyond the state, that they create a source of money flowing into the state and support local serving industries, including retail, that they do depend on reliable connections, and if in fact those connections are not there and the cost of that particular service is too great, they will locate elsewhere. What keeps these businesses up at night is the following. Will products arrive on time? Will the finished product make the connection out of Oregon? Will they have to shut their production processes down early to beat traffic? And are there good connections to their markets, and at what cost? So what that means is that we really have to be cognizant of linking our transportation system to our economic development strategy. And what that means is really the following, putting the right infrastructure in the right place, that we have access to the export facilities on industrial property, that we address multiple modes. There's availability of carrier service linking to those markets, and that we have supportive public policy as well as funding. For infrastructure specifically, we need to understand what the commodity types are that are moving and match those infrastructure investments with the geography and the product origin and destination for that particular market. for access, that means that we have to have efficient access to industrial properties. That means the last mile has to perform well and efficiently for those businesses. And of course, we continue to talk about multiple modes. Just like on the passenger side, having a system that is coordinated and linked and is supportive of multiple modes for multiple industries becomes critical. For service, this is something that we at the Port of Portland are all too familiar with. Having the right service to the right markets becomes critical. It's a little bit of the chicken and egg syndrome. You've got to have the right volume to attract the service, but then you've got to have the right service to attract the volume. It becomes a real challenge in terms of accomplishing the service for the industries that we need. What that means is that we have to make the most of our marine and rail connections as well as our air service. Impacts, the lack of service means that we force some of the exporters out of market, or there's extra handling or longer transit time, which can hinder our perishable and high-value product shipments. As far as public policy goes, this gives you a quick overview of the number of issues that relate to public policy that can impact both the transportation system's availability and efficiency as well as the economic viability of exports. But what you all have heard many times over is that our transportation networks are clogged and congested. And fundamentally what that means is that we need funding for the transportation system. It means that we need to make improvements to our channels and jetties, that we need to make sure that our runways are performing adequately for the type of service that is going to be relying on it, that we have the service connections between the road and the rail system, and that those major corridors that we know are the critical commodity flow corridors are improved adequately, and that we continue to expand the use of technology to really understand what the needs are and to be able to make more cost-effective investments in the system. Last point, this represents really the things that we need to do to address exports and linking it to our transportation system to that strategy. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for these? Representative Weider.
I'll go ahead and fire away. And just, Susie or Derek, either one of you, whichever wants to tackle this, but wondering, one of the problems we've seen in some of the ports are some of the fights that the unions are having over jobs, and they're holding up products getting shipped.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if we did something in Oregon to where we stopped that from happening here in the state, if it would make a difference to help you bring people to our ports to want to ship out of our ports, knowing their freight and goods aren't going to get held up and they're going to get loaded on a ship, especially when you're dealing with vegetables, fruit, things like that, which is a big export out of our community, if we could stop that, because they're basically holding goods hostage, and I almost consider it stealing, because especially when you're dealing with produce, you're destroying someone's livelihood by this. If we could come up with a way to stop that from happening, would that help you bring people to the ports of Oregon?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Wigner. I'm going to give that to Derek to answer. No, just kidding. obviously, the labor challenges create difficulties for businesses that are moving products through the ports, and it would be very beneficial to the extent that we can continue to move our products efficiently. It is not something that is limited to the state of Oregon, obviously. This is a both West Coast as well as nationwide challenge that we all have to face, and it has to do really with contract timing and products that are moving, the situations in various jurisdictions. So we are all working very hard to ensure that this does not create a problem for our businesses, but it is part of doing work in the port arena.
If I may follow this, I realize it's not just here in Oregon. I mean, it's been a small piece. What was happening down in California was even worse. I know companies that had their stuff. I'm saying, would this give you a competitive advantage to draw, hey, I'm not going to go out of California knowing my freight won't get held up in Oregon, to bring
more exports and imports out of our ports right here to go out and say to these guys, hey, if you use our ports, your freight's not going to get held up. You think, would that help us get to this goal from 20 to 40 quickly?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Wiener. It's pretty complicated in terms of all of the elements that are necessary to be in place to grow the kind of exports that we're talking about. Certainly, reliability of the transportation system is right up at the very top. So having a way to ensure our businesses that they can rely on the transportation system to move their products out would be beneficial.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Pence, Representative Widener. I also just emphasize.
Actually, Widener.
Widener, excuse me, sorry, sir. Widener, I'm on the in the export initiative. We are trying to look at the leakage issue as far as what's causing some freight to not go out through the Port of Portland, and are there things that could be addressed to do that. So that's sort of a more longer term and not a short term, but taking a look at some of the issues that are out there that might cause a shipper to go up to Seattle Tacoma or down to Long Beach or out by a truck or something like that. So that is, it's not specifically the issue that you asked about, but it is getting to a larger issue of how do we ensure that the most freight possible is shipped through the region.
I really don't think they ever tackled that question, so on saying would it help. Because I'm sitting here looking at this thinking, what would give me a competitive advantage over every other port? And to me, the first port that does this, because we do it with our police that can't go on strike. I mean, and this is, to me, almost falls into that category. So it's what I need from you to say. I mean, if you think it's something that would be beneficial, I know for me, if I was out having to sell the port, our ports in Oregon, I mean, I would have a heyday with that one item going out to all these shippers and saying, hey, if you go through our ports, your freight's not going to get held up. A strike's not going to happen. We're not going to have two guys fighting over a job shutting down our whole port. So would it increase the amount of freight that we could put through our ports if we could come up with a solution to keep that from type of thing from happening here in Oregon? Just yes or no would work.
Or you can answer any way you like.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Widener. What I would say to that is that it really does matter about the reliability of the system, and having some certainty is valuable. And so in some ways that's a yes. That doesn't guarantee, however, that you're automatically going to increase product through your port. As I mentioned earlier in my presentation, some of the challenges that we face is that you really have to have enough volume to attract the carrier service. And it has to be important for them from a financial standpoint to be able to call the particular port. So it's a volume and carrier call kind of issue that really is fundamental to growing exports and international trade at the port.
Understood.
Appreciate you both being there. Thanks for your work on this. Keep going.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are now going to move on to a series of panels. There's been a lot of discussion across our state around the issue of potential coal exports. And it's one of those issues where I think there's probably been more heat than light in a lot of the discussions that have been taking place. And so we hope to have lots of light in from all sides of this issue today to dig into this. And we're going to begin by inviting Heidi Ford to talk about really to help as we're looking at potential legislative proposals that may come on this or related funding proposals, what is the legislature's scope? Because there are, like on most issues, there are some things the legislature can have authority to control and other things where that may not be true. So we appreciate you being here to kick this off.
Okay. Hello, Co-Chair Bench and Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee. My name is Heidi Elliott, and I'm an attorney with the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I'm here today to answer a question for you. Is Oregon preempted from regulating the transportation of coal by rail? And after doing some research, I believe the answer is yes. In an effort to prevent a patchwork of local regulation of rail, Congress and the courts...
Heidi, can you move the mic just a little bit closer? That'd be great.
That work?
Yep.
So in an effort to prevent a local patchwork of regulations of rail transportation, Congress and the courts have long recognized the need to regulate rail at a federal level. In 1995, Congress created the Surface Transportation Board and granted the board exclusive jurisdiction over the transportation by rail carriers. This leaves little room for the states. In an effort to avoid a preemption challenge, the states must meet two requirements when they pass a law regulating rail. The laws must be generally applicable, and the laws must not unreasonably burden rail transportation. For example, things like building codes, fire codes, electrical codes are all generally applicable and have been deemed okay by the board and the circuit courts. What are not permissible are those laws that are deemed to manage or govern rail transportation, those laws that specifically target rail transportation, and those laws that are seen to be, again, unreasonably burdensome to rail transportation. Of course, it begs the question, what does that mean to be unreasonably burdensome, especially when states have the authority to protect the public health and safety of its citizens? After doing some research, I came across a number of examples, and I'll just share three with you today. One of them comes from Washington, D.C. In 2005, in an effort to prevent acts of terrorism, D.C. passed an ordinance requiring a permit before carrying hazardous waste by rail within 2 miles of the United States Capitol. The Surface Transportation Board said that this is an unreasonable burden and that the ordinance was preempted by federal law. In Washington State in 1998, the local government wanted a local environmental review before a rail line was to extend its line, and the Surface Transportation Board and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals held that this local environmental review was an unreasonable burden and also preempted by federal law. Most recently, in 2010, out of California, there's a local air quality district that wanted to limit air emissions from idling trains and wanted the rail carriers to submit reports. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals held that this, too, was an unreasonable burden on rail carriers and also preempted it from federal law. So as you can see, the scope of federal law is broad and comprehensive and leaves little room for the states. That's what I can offer you today.
Very concise and helpful. Questions? Co-Chair Vance.
Thank you, Chair. So the focus was on rail. There's the train, when it gets wherever it's going, has to unload. Where does rail stop and something else begin?
There is some question. In one of the cases, I found that rail transportation, the definition of transportation in the federal code includes vessels. So that may include transportation by rail carriers on the water as well. I don't know if that would necessarily include the barges, if they were considered transportation by rail, by the rail carriers or not.
I didn't phrase my question appropriately, but the thought would be the rail crosses, the coal crosses Oregon, reaches a port, the coal is offloaded to a facility, and then loaded from the facility onto a ship. At any point in that sequence, does the law that you talked about not apply? In other words, we're talking about railroads and the ability of a state to do something about railroads. Is it equally barred when it comes to the facilities needed to offload the coal onto a ship?
Co-Chair Vance, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, I believe that once it gets to the port, other issues may arise, but I think at that point, at the port, it supports jurisdiction and no longer the rail. I'm not 100% sure. I have to look more into that.
A follow-up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question also, tax or fees charged by a state, do they fall within the definition of unreasonably burdensome if the state decided it wanted to impose some onerous or any charge?
Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, it would be fact-specific. It would depend on how those taxes or fees would affect the rail operations or rail transportation. And the courts would have to look at that and see if that created an unreasonable burdensome. It was unreasonably burdensome or specifically targeted them at that point, then there is a question of preemption.
And a follow-up to that. In conversations recently, it appeared that there are other laws that would prohibit a state from imposing any kind of a fee having to do with constitutionality of exports. So if the coal is going to be exported, my understanding is that there is no way that the state can impose a tax or a fee under the U.S. Constitution. I know that the question we presented did not ask you to answer this particular question, but did you by any chance look into that just as a under the unreasonable label?
Contra Vance, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, no, I did not look into the tax implications of. I can't answer your taxation questions.
That's fine. Thank you.
That I think that would be valuable if you could in the future look into that, because I think
I can talk to the person in our office who know more about that.
I think that would be valuable for the next legislature to have early on an answer to that question, because that's an important question. Other questions for Heidi? And is the basic content of everything you said in your testimony, is that either already in an LC opinion, or are you in the process of putting that into an opinion that would be generally available to the legislature?
Yes, I can put together a memo, if you like, or opinion.
Yeah.
Just make that available.
Useful, especially folding in Co-Chair Bence's question and response to that.
Okay.
I've seen nodding heads. Great.
You so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we'll invite Jay and Jerry and Brock to come forward and talk about several proposals that have been. Actually, is there a third free chair? Because that one's attached. There, Cindy just freed that one. Okay. Brock, you're going to have to stand. I'm sorry.
I can do that.
Yeah, I've got to use the.
Okay.
Please, we appreciate you being here and invite you to proceed in whatever order is helpful, and if you could be introducing yourself for the record.
Committee chairs, members of the committee, I'm Jay Waldron. I'm an attorney that represents the Moro Pacific Project. In my distant past, I was president of the Port of Portland Commission, so I have quite a bit of familiarity with exports. And I thought I'd begin by telling you a little bit about coal exports, and then I'm going to talk about the Moro Pacific Project briefly. It's probably the least rail-centric project, but the most barge-centric. As probably most of you know, last year we exported 114 million tons of coal. It's the United States' second largest export to wheat. The primary market is Europe. We serve Europe along with Russia. Last year, 50 million tons of coal went down the Mississippi River by barge to be exported to Europe and to Asia. Currently, 10 million tons go down the Columbia Gorge every year from the Powder River Basin. And currently, 6 million tons of U.S. coal go through Vancouver, B.C., and are exported to Asia. That coal basically goes down the gorge and then goes to Vancouver. The Moro Pacific Project expects to export 3.3 million tons at the outset, and its maximum capacity is 8.8 million tons. The Moro Pacific Project currently has contracts with South Korea and expects to export to South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan. You asked about a number of questions about the environment, and for us,
hope is on the way.
Obviously, at my age, I'm technologically challenged.
If you just hit the right arrow, it should advance. Well, maybe not.
It's not going. Actually, down arrow at that one.
Okay. Yeah, maybe.
Of course, that's our promise to everyone that we'll meet the high standards of doing business that everyone in Oregon expects. This is the project. We will get low sulfur, low mercury coal from the Intermountain area. We will transfer it. It will be taken by rail to the Port of Morro. By tariff, we will agree to load profile and to spray surfactant on it. There will be no measurable coal dust in Oregon from this project. At the Port of Morro, we will transfer it to barges to the Port of St. Helens at Port Westward. There we will use what I'll explain, a Suratel loader to load that onto vessels. There will be, in this process, no visible coal and no coal dust. The project is designed, as the slide shows, to eliminate any coal dust and spillage. There are no coal piles, and all of the operations, from soup to nuts, from the Port of Morro to the Port of St. Helens, will be enclosed. This is what the Morro Pacific Project will look like at the Port of Morro. If it isn't successful, which people raise from time to time, it could switch right over to food processing and to shipping food. That's how clean it is. The coal will be unloaded in an indoor building, which you see on the bottom right. It will then be go into the enclosed loader. It will go into enclosed barges, or it will be stored in enclosed warehouses. This is the newest, most unique way to move coal in the world. It is not moved like this any other place. At the Port of Morro, there will be no coal pile. There will be no land use. It will be loaded from covered barges by a Suratel loader, which will be designed on pontoons with an auger to auger the coal up and then to deposit it into the Panamax ship. Again, no visible coal, no coal dust. We've gone to Taiwan and looked at this process. Taiwan is, as you can imagine, while they're far ahead of us in renewable resources, also has no resources and has to burn coal, particularly to produce steel. And they unload a lot of their coal vessels in downtown of cities. And so they have developed this with a Swedish company. They use this Suratel loader. It also unloads cement and products like that with no dust. To describe the barges, they will be covered. They are the same way we ship the other bulk commodities on the Columbia River. As you know, the transportation of coal by barge and ocean-going vessels is well established. I think there's something in the neighborhood of 1 billion tons of coal that are shipped around the world every year. And there's 50 million tons of coal that's shipped down the Mississippi River currently. And there's ample capacity, as perhaps Representative Hunt would know, on the Columbia and Snake River. This will put the barges and tugs at about the 1993 level, which when we were shipping a lot more wood chips. It will also provide a great deal of user fees to help maintain the Columbia River system for other commodities. I guess I'm one ahead here, but we're going to invest in Oregon with a $242 million capital investment. It'll be 1,000 ongoing operations-related jobs. It'll be more than 2,100 temporary construction-related jobs. We have signed a letter of intent with Gunnarsson and Vigor for the construction of 20 covered barges in Portland for over $75 million. I didn't mean to jump so far, but I don't quite know how to get all the way back. Let's see if I'm there. We are, like any Oregon business, we want to be good neighbors. And we want to support the communities that we're locating in. At full capacity, we'll pay $1 million in property taxes to Columbia County. At full capacity, we'll pay $2.9 million in property taxes to Morrow County. We did not ask for any enterprise zone or any other type of tax break. We will pay an $850,000 annual fee to the Port of St. Helens and an $850,000 annual fee to the Port of Morrow based on our initial capacity. We have applied for all of our permits at this time, and we are hopeful of starting in mid or late 2014. In addition to that, knowing that schools are a key concern of so many Oregonians, we've agreed to make a 10% per ton voluntary contribution to the schools in Columbia County and the schools in Morrow County. That will start at $350,000 a year in each county and will continue to full capacity till it's $800,000 a year. In another life, being a former school board chair, I can't describe how important that will be to those two counties. That's a significant amount of money to address school issues in those counties. We are in the review process now. We have applied for an Army Corps of Engineers Section 10 permit. We prepared an 1,100-page environmental review, probably the largest environmental review the Corps has ever received. We are also in the process of applying for permits from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality for air, stormwater, and wastewater. We intend to have no discharge for water at the site. And the air permit, our current calculations at the site are 300 pounds a year. The standard is 20 tons. But we applied for an air permit. DEQ said we didn't need one. Then they have decided we need one so they can regulate us and make sure we do everything we've promised. We'll also get a fill permit from the Oregon Department of State Lands and various construction permits. We have tried to, I'm pretty incompetent at this. We've tried to reach out to local communities. We've done 50 public presentations. We sent 3,700 supportive comments to the Corps, not by just punching an email button. We have more than 1,700 supporters. You may have seen the ad of a partial list of supporters last Friday in the Oregonian. We are supported by ILWU Local 21, whom we will deal with at the Port of St. Helens. We're supported by the Pendleton Building and Construction Trades. And you've probably read a lot about this project, and perhaps not have the same impression from the media as what's actually going on. In March of 2012, we got Adam and Tim Hibbets and Migdal to do a poll of Oregonians, and it's favored statewide 55% to 40%. In Morrow County, it was 62%. In Columbia County, it was 63%. We commissioned that poll. So let's look a little further. Recently, the Alliance for Northwest Jobs and Exports got GS Strategies from Boise to do a poll for 400 respondents. That showed 54.5% of those in Oregon support the export of coal. And just to make sure you understand that everything is nonpartisan, the Northwest Public Radio's EarthFix Network just did a poll again with David Davis Hibbets, and it's 55%. in favor. So the summary of our project is 3,100 jobs, $242 million capital investment. We'll pay our property taxes. We'll contribute to schools. We believe this is a textbook example of the kind of activity that the port and the river system is designed to encourage. We're doing it what we consider the Oregon way, and this is going to set a new standard in the world for the movement of coal. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen?
Do you want?
Want me to go while you're setting that up?
People.
Co-chairs Hunt and Bentz, committee members. I'm Brock Nelson, Director of Public Affairs for Union Pacific Railroad. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. I distributed a fact sheet that's got some information on it to try and frame what this means from a UP perspective. And obviously, in the last 6 months, the public has become very impassioned on this issue. So we're trying to get out and communicate what it means to UP. UP has a lot of experience moving coal. We've been moving coal for decades. Currently, we move about 50 trains a day through thousands of communities, but we don't have that history and experience up in the Pacific Northwest. Most of this, these trains are serving utilities back in the Midwest and down in the Gulf region. The closest facility that we serve currently is the PGE facility out at Boardman. There the coal trains come down from Spokane to Boardman and back. I think it's a couple of trains a week. So again, we don't have a long history of moving coal in the Pacific Northwest. There's, of course, five facilities that are talking about exporting coal. Three of them, if built, could mean coal traffic on Union Pacific. The first would be the Port of Morrow facility out near Boardman. The second would be the Port of Coos Bay's facility, of course, southwest of Eugene. And then lastly, a facility in Longview, Washington. So, but that could result in some coal train traffic on UP. Obviously, the Port of Morrow facility wouldn't result in anything moving through the gorge. Port of Coos Bay, we would move coal trains through the gorge and then south through Eugene and then hand it off to the Port of Coos Bay, and they'd take it down to their facility. And then if Longview's successful in getting a facility built, the coal could come on our side of the gorge, and then it would go north in Portland up to Longview. There's some independent studies that indicate that traffic would be in the neighborhood of 6 to 9 trains a day, and I know you've got some folks from the Port of Coos Bay coming, so they can kind of frame what it means to them, but what I've heard from the presentations is they're talking about 2 to 4 trains a day at maximum build out, so that would be 2 loaded and then the corresponding empties going back. It's hard for me to quantify what Longview means to UP at this point. Both BN and UP have access into that facility, and I don't have a whole lot of information to quantify what that means, but to us. But we feel that we've got the capacity today to handle the additional traffic that's being talked about, and in reality, if you were to add these trains to our current traffic, you'd still be below our historic peaks back prior to 2007. So again, we've got the ability to move it. We won't move any of this new business at the expense of existing customers or at the expense of any existing passenger service. If there's capacity needs, and not unlike we would look at for any commodity, if it makes business sense, that's the kind of investment that UP would make in the state, and that benefits the state and the local and regional and global network. Coal trains won't be
any longer than other trains that we move through the area. There's a lot of things that go into determining the length of a train, and obviously the physical length of yard tracks and sidings is a key, but so is mountain, the grades and the curvature, and tonnage is really probably the biggest single thing that goes into determining the length of a train. And so in reality, your coal trains might be even shorter than other trains that move through the area currently. Union Pacific is going to require that any coal moving from the North Powder River Basin to facilities in Oregon use surfactants to control dust. Currently, that's a recommendation, and again, we're going to require that it be used. And we're also involved in ongoing discussions about whether or not an actual fixed hard cover could be used, but that's a much more complex discussion because now you need to engage the facility that's loading it, the facility that's unloading it, and the car owners. But again, in the short term, we'll require the use of surfactants to control the dust. Freight rail transportation is extremely safe, very environmentally friendly. You know, we're in the business of moving freight. We're looking forward to being able to serve these facilities, assuming they get built. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Yeah, we'll take questions for all three of you then. So okay. Go ahead, Jake.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, and members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak today. My name is Jerry Vest. I'm Vice President of Government and Industry Affairs for Genesee and Wyoming. We're the parent company of the Portland and Western Railroad. G&W dates back to 1899 in the United States, and our focus is short line freight operations. We've had a presence here in Oregon for about 20 years now, and we're happy to be here. Most of you all know the Portland Western, but let me just very, very briefly recap who we are in Oregon. We have 514 miles of track. We serve 136 customers that depend on our freight services. We're tracking this year to handle about 63,000 freight car shipments, which is significantly below the levels we had pre-2008 recession. And tied to that fall off in traffic are the commodities we now primarily handle on the railroad, and it's logs, wood chip, lumber, and paper, and pulp chips. We have approximately 160 employees. We're headquartered in Salem, right here in Salem. We are extraordinarily focused on safety, as I think all the freight railroads are. Certainly the Union Pacific is. We feel we're a leader in rail freight safety in the United States. You can think of the E.H. Harriman Safety Awards as the Emmy Awards for rail freight companies in terms of safety, and our commitment to safety is reflected here in Oregon by winning the gold, the highest level Harriman Award in 2008 for our employee safety performance. Earlier this year, we won the silver, the second highest award, that was I think indicative of our efforts for our companies. The disappointment that folks on the Portland Western might have experienced in not getting the gold was tempered that a sister G&W Railroad, the Buffalo and Pittsburgh, won the gold this year. So we take safety very, very, very seriously. We look on this opportunity for export coal to the Pacific Rim, driven by the continued demand for coal and growth in that economy of the countries of the Pacific Rim, is a serious and meaningful opportunity, not only for the Portland Western Railroad, but for the region and Oregon at large. We are involved with a company, Kinder Morgan, that's under consideration of building a new export coal facility at Port Westwood in Columbia County. We would be the serving carrier for that facility for the trains from the Powder River Basin, which is you see on the first maps, about 1,300 miles from Gillette, Wyoming, the heart of the Powder River Basin, to Port Westwood. We would handle the last 53.5 miles from basically Portland to Port Westwood. There are several reasons why this is a worthwhile and important opportunity for Oregon. Let me step through those briefly. First, it creates new employment opportunities. In addition to the hundreds of jobs, the construction and operations of a new export coal facility would create at Port Westward, we would be looking to add permanent employment positions to handle this traffic. Doing our estimates at full volume, we would be adding approximately 30 jobs to the railroad. And that's a significant increase over the 160 employment we have today. Those jobs, the benefits and base salary total between $77,000 and $100,000 each. This is significant in that most of these jobs, approximately 28 of the 30 jobs, would be in Columbia County. And that area certainly would need and appreciate that job growth. Second, this project would have the opportunity, a very meaningful opportunity, to improve the transportation infrastructure in the state of Oregon and on what this line from Portland to Port Westward, our story line, represents. You all understand how capital intensive any mode of surface transportation can be. And your oversight of the roadways of the state of Oregon. A recent Association of American Railroads study found that freight railroading was one of the most capital-intensive industries in the United States, that of every dollar that was received in gross revenues, almost 18 cents of it was reinvested back into capital improvements and maintenance. So extraordinarily capital-intensive, and the vast bulk of this funding comes from our own revenues. So what we really have here is an opportunity through a significant increase in traffic for us to improve and assure the long-term viability of our Astoria line. And there's a misconception out there, and Brock touched on it briefly, that somehow this export traffic will crowd out or inhibit our current traffic or other future traffic growth. At the Portland Western, it's quite the opposite. We are facing a dire need for more traffic on the A line. And what we will have, if we cannot find this growth, is a potential deterioration long-term of this line. We have to fund the maintenance and ongoing expenses to maintain and upgrade this line ourselves, and this type of traffic is critical for that. We, as I said before, are a long way from recovering from the 2008 recession, and this opportunity will give us the viability we need for this line and to serve the communities that are along it and our customers. The third point, this opportunity is actually good for the environment. This probably sounds contrary to some of the press that people that simply don't want the coal to ever be mined are putting forward, but let me explain it. Like Brock's comment in the Union Pacific, we have an understanding and it will be a firm commitment when this project goes that any coal car going to Port Westward over our railroad will be treated by the state-of-the-art treatment to manage coal dust. Currently, that state-of-the-art treatment is two procedures. One is a loading profile in the Powder River Basin to minimize as much as possible any coal dust coming off the top of the car. And the second element of it is a spray coating or surfactant that is put on at the mine to basically crust the top of the car's coal load to prevent coal dust from coming off. But this commitment will be for whatever the state of the art is. If there are improvements in the way coal dust is managed, we will have an agreement with the shippers that the shipments will have that type of treatment or be affected that way. So beyond coal dust, the impact for the environment is one in which ensuring the viability of our line, the Astoria line, you have to look at what that line is providing even today in terms of an alternate transportation mode to keep customers' traffic off of US 30 and the roadways of Oregon. And this is key. We believe that that will actually have a long-term benefit of keeping at today's levels of traffic, which, as I mentioned before, are depressed. 360 trucks a day, a work day, a five-day work week off of US 30. So rail freight emits on a ton-mile basis a quarter of the pollution of a typical tractor-trailer shipment, and on a ton-mile basis uses a quarter of the fuel. We as an industry can handle a ton of freight on a gallon of fuel almost 500 miles. The efficiencies and the environmental benefits of rail shipment are absolutely phenomenal. The only thing that probably beats it is a barge going downriver. And so we are quite proud of this. This is something that we as an industry bring to the environment that is often not either understood or overlooked by the general population. But this green element of our industry will be actually be largely strengthened and supported by this project. An example of what all this means would be in Rainier. In Columbia County, there are two major industrial employers in Rainier that have total employment of approximately 370 jobs. Teven Brothers, which handles log transloading for export, and U.S. Gypsum, a drywall manufacturing plant. These companies, if they don't have our rail freight services provided by the Portland Western Railroad, they are a significant disadvantage in competing in their marketplaces and serving their customers. They need our rail services. Those 370 jobs, are tied to our rail services very directly. And if you took the total carload, rail carload traffic we're handling for these customers this year, it's an equivalent of 57,600 trucks this year that we're keeping off of US 30 and off of I-5 and other roads. And this traffic is very truck competitive. Teven's Brothers log shipments originate largely in Oregon on our railroad. This is a rare kind of occurrence where we're actually the whole haul. We're not interchanging the traffic or receiving it from a Union Pacific or BNSF. So this traffic, without us there, this traffic could easily flip to the highway. So helping the Astoria line to be able to maintain its viability, to improve its infrastructure, is absolutely key.
And Jerry, if you could try to wrap it up.
Yes, sir.
That'd be great.
Last slide. So our focus going forward. We have begun dialogues in the four communities in Columbia County to bring together a cross-section of those communities, the mayors, the other city officials and thought leaders in those communities. We have had a series of ongoing meetings that we are continuing to understand their concerns and to work to address them. The great thing about this project, it will generate enough revenue for us to be able to help work with those communities to address problems that actually predate any of us in this room. The street trackage in Rainier, the location of our yard in St. Helens, that just to switch the yard we end up blocking streets, those type of things we're looking at with those communities. We are eager to finalize the development, the infrastructure improvement, the operating plans to handle this traffic. We're in the process of working through those, and we feel this is fully able to be done, and to be done in a way that is sensitive to the environment and the communities we're going to pass through. And so we're going to work absolutely to ensure that this project's handled in a safe and environmentally advantageous way, and to continue our track record of being good neighbors in the communities we serve. Gentlemen and lady, thank you very much.
Thank you. You can see from the next panel, we're going to hear from folks from individual ports, so you may have questions you want to hold for them, but any questions for these three gentlemen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can one of you explain how the surfactant works and what that sort of looks like and what the actual numbers are regarding the dust issue?
Co-chairs and Representative Sheehan, the surfactant is, I've had it somewhat explained to me, it's almost like a hairspray type application that would go on the surface of the car after it's profiled, like Jerry mentioned.
from a UP perspective, the issue of dust has been more prevalent, really, at locations much closer to the mine and in areas where you have a lot more trains, coal trains moving than you'll ever see in the state of Oregon. But it is used to control the dust. I don't have any data to say how effective it is, you know, at the point of origin or at the point 1,000 miles away, but it is the best practice that we have today. Again, currently recommended, and we're going to require it for anything moving in Oregon.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, Representative Sheehan, great question. This is something we take very, very seriously, and we think our interests on coal dust are perfectly aligned with the communities we pass through. If you think about it, the first property that coal dust would fall on, if it wasn't controlled properly, would be the railroads. We don't want the coal dust any more than our neighbors that we pass through in delivering the coal. The surfactant is basically a crusting agent, as Brock said, and what happens is it contains the top of the car, and these cars will be rotary dumped to be emptied, and so basically just breaks into the coal when it's discharged.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
If I might add, the one study I've seen is it's about 90% effective initially, and beyond that as you move down the line. And the way it's been described to me is like going to Dairy Queen and putting the chocolate on the cone. It's glycol. They are glycol-based, and I know that Burlington Northern tested about 8 of them and has selected the 3 that are the least harmful and the most effective.
Thank you.
Mr. Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Jay. We heard from Legislative Council that states can't do anything to unduly burden rail traffic. What is it that the railroad is concerned about that this body or others might do to stop this from happening?
Well, obviously we're not the sort of the rail-centric project because we're going to the Port of Morrow. We're not really going through any Oregon community that has certain types of concerns. Interstate commerce, and it's very, I mean, that's going back to I think I went to a few classes in law school, and it's pretty inviolate that you cannot really burden in any way, as Legislative Council said, anything to do with interstate commerce, and of course the rail is governed by the federal government. We are more focused on our Corps of Engineers Section 10 permit and our Department of Environmental Quality air permit, both of which we're in the process of obtaining right now.
Follow up.
Please.
Right, that's it. That is my question. Really, at what point does the state's position on those permits become unduly burdensome, or does the DEQ and the Corps have unlimited ability to say, gee, we just don't like coal, so don't?
Well, there are certain standards for the Corps, and as you know, there's, I don't know how many, but there's dozens of docks permitted on the Mississippi. There's 100 docks permitted on the Columbia. It's not based on the commodity. It's based on what environmental action it will cause in the receiving body, like the Columbia River or the Mississippi River. So if the Corps has a set of regulations that we believe we've complied with, state of Oregon, as I explained, the primary permit is the air permit. The standard, even to get a permit, is 10 tons, and we our calculations are 200 to 300 pounds.
The final follow-up, and again, this question I asked Heidi earlier, but it was taxes. If someone said, "Gee, this is a great opportunity to impose a levy on all this coal flowing through Oregon," what's the? My understanding is we can't. But is that your understanding also?
It's my understanding, but there's no underestimating lawyers.
Proper answer, yes.
Representative Bentz always trying to tax things. We have to watch
constantly. Yes, constantly.
In effect, by the way, we are, in effect, paying self-imposed property taxes. We didn't ask for an enterprise zone, and we are going to donate to the school, which would be more than our share of school taxes. So we're trying to be a good neighbor, good citizen, kind of the old-fashioned way by agreeing to do it that way.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks. Thanks for the presentations. It seems like there's several elements of the Morrow project that appear to be unique, including the barges that are covered, including the totally enclosed storage facilities, some innovations that might well be just what the doctor ordered in terms of health and safety. What operating experiences Ambre Energy have and give us the confidence that sort of we have the experience to operate those new and innovative stuff well?
Two things. One, they have had very little experience. Amber owns two mines. It owns facilities in Australia. It's really a group of people who have been selling coal from Australia, and the CEO is a person who's known in the coal industry for his innovative technology that he's developed. But just like lawyers would do, we've hired the best and brightest. We've hired Taggart and other folks who have built these kind of facilities. We've hired people that have looked at sewer tail loaders and so forth. So that's what we've done, Representative Smith, is get the people that know what they're doing to do this.
Okay. I can follow up. Well, no, but I guess I have a bunch of questions. This is really important, and I'm not going to be able to ask these questions again. Can I ask several questions? So the best and brightest, they're real smart. If this stuff is kind of new, when's the last time they did it? They did it in Korea, they did it in somewhere else?
Well, let me back up. No one has really put coal in storage facilities.
Yeah.
Coal is stored in piles. You know, there's a large pile sitting at the Boardman coal plant right now, and there's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 coal piles around the United States. So they have hired people who have designed warehouses and who have addressed coal piles, and they're confident that they can store it in warehouses, that they can suppress it. We've designed scrubbers for it. We've hired Golder, who's probably the leading experts in Oregon on air, Representative Smith. And then on the sewer tail loader, we've gone over to Sweden. We've seen it operated. We've seen it operated, for example, down in the Gulf for cement. And we've gone over and looked at it. People from Amber have gone over and looked at it in Taiwan and seen it operate on land in Taiwan. And so we're going to design with Frank Foti and Vigor. We're designing it to work on a pontoon barge.
As I understand it, the terminals for Bellingham and Longview will have an independent analysis, including pretty robust public participation. I don't know what we're planning here. Do you support a sort of similar process, a similar environmental impact statement for this facility?
Well, yes, mostly. And the yes, mostly, besides being a lawyer answer, is that we welcome any scrutiny so long as it's within the regulation. So we've had recently three informational hearings, which is pretty close to unprecedented with the DEQ, and then there'll be a hearing on the draft permit. The Corps, we've given them the 1,100-page environmental review. As you know, most docs are a 20 or 30-page environmental assessment, and they are now going to go through their process where they have forwarded it on to the National Marine Fisheries Service, to NOAA, and to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have done the most comprehensive cultural resources survey probably in the history of the state, both on land, and we're probably the first, as Representative Hunt might attest to. We actually hired divers and investigated the submerged lands off the Port of Morro. So we've welcomed all that scrutiny, and we've gone, as I mentioned, our crew has gone and faced just about anybody we could get an invite to tell them exactly what we're doing and to answer questions. And finally, some of the design from our early meetings with people has changed for the better because I think we've listened. That's particularly true of the Suertel loader.
So I heard the mostly,
and then I heard various ways you'll make your pitch and hear other people's pitch. What's the not? You know, what's the piece that makes you uncomfortable? Or I can repeat the question: are you comfortable with environmental impact statement, looking at the whole deal, having independent analysis of what's going on, not just you getting the pitch and hearing from a critic, but having an independent analysis to make sure we're doing something smart, given this coal is a little bit different than some of the coal that we're piling up in other parts of the country, right? It's a little more combustible, a little finer grain.
Yes, but the environmental assessment process, we welcome, and there's going to be a core hearing on it.
And we want to give time to hear from all the remaining testimony, so if you could be...
You sure? All right. I'll try to cut it down to two more. Brock, if we build all the terminals that we're talking about, Coos, St. Helens, Longview, Bellingham, how many coal trains we're thinking this is going to require? How long are the trains?
Well, the maximum, Representative Smith, the maximum train that we can handle in this area is 7,200 feet long. Mm-hmm. So it's less than a mile and a half.
A mile and a half trains.
Yeah. There's third-party studies that are out there indicating that if Coos Bay is built and at maximum capacity, if Longview is at maximum capacity, that would mean 6 to 9 trains going through the gorge on Union Pacific. We kind of believe internally that number is overstated. But again, that presumes that all those facilities are going to be built, and I can't speak to whether they will or not. But we can handle that that business in the future if those facilities are constructed.
Last question. How does our, I know we're facing legal challenges with interstate commerce, and I hope we will think about how to sort of minimize the public cost and maximize the public benefit of whatever happens. How does Oregon's legal authority compare to Washington's in terms of the review of the impacts of the proposals? Obviously, they've got the same United States Constitution, and I'm not sure who's best suited to answer that question. But how does our authority relate to theirs?
I can give you a short answer. It's essentially, I don't know, other than that they're virtually identical because as you would know, interstate commerce trumps.
Okay. Thanks very much. I can hold off.
And let's actually, Patrick, if you could follow up with Heidi and have her incorporate an answer to that question in
compared to
Washington. That would be a helpful addition, I think. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Gary, Patrick, David, come on down. Go in whatever order you'd prefer. If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Start east to move west.
I guess I'm going to go upriver. Chair Hunt and Vince, members of the committee, my name is Gary Neal. I'm the general manager of the Port of Morrow.
And Gary, I'm sorry, if I could just say, if you guys could each be as brief as possible, because we are running a little bit behind.
I'll be happy to be brief. Thank you. At our end of the system of this particular project, Jay Waldron obviously gave you a presentation, so he hit on most of the facts that I would be able to even share with you today. Other than a couple of items that I think are important, you know, I've been involved in the port business since 1980, and this is my first experience where I've seen the railroads and the barging collaborate on a project, and I'm excited about that because it's a true intermodal opportunity to take advantage of the system that we all strive to help make the most efficient and most beneficial use to the public and to the people we represent in the movement of commodities. And the port has made substantial investment over the last 10 years in rail infrastructure, and the opportunity to collaborate with the Union Pacific on utilizing those rail improvements on mainline sidings and loop tracks and transferring over to the river system to end up down at St. Helens is is a good utilization of our system and probably mitigates a lot of questions and concerns that people may have if they take a look at the facts. And the jobs are important to us. The opportunity to move a commodity onto the river system is important to us, and to utilize our rail infrastructure that we've made the investment in as well. Property tax dollars are good. The school benefits are good, and we're going to lose some cold jobs in 2020, if you're probably familiar with that. Here's an opportunity to replace some of those jobs with some other good paying jobs along the way. But with that, I'd be happy to pass it on to my neighbor downstream. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee, I'm Patrick Trapp. I'm the Executive Director for the Port of St. Helens. Thank you today for including me in this robust discussion. As Gary had indicated here, we have one project with Port of Morrill on a regional opportunity here, basically a short sea shipping opportunity to take coal, this dry bulk commodity, from the Port of Morrill to the Port of St. Helens via covered barges, and then from there transloaded directly onto ocean-going ships onto the Asian market. In addition to that, we have the more traditional project with Kinder Morgan as a option also, and that, of course, as you've heard already, would take advantage of the P&W rail, short line rail, to bring in coal stockpile and then further transload that via conveyor onto, again, ocean-going ships at the dock. At Port of St. Helens, we're fortunate but also challenged in the fact that we have a exceptionally strategic 1,700-acre industrial site that is underutilized. We have a 1,200-foot deep water dock with 50 to 70 feet self-scouring right along the Columbia River, which is underutilized and barely employed right now, with the exception of the Columbia Pacific biorefinery, the ethanol plant there. And these two projects offer significant opportunities to provide much-needed resources, significantly needed employment opportunities, to start that critical investment into capital improvements and capital reinvestment so that we can continue to attract industrial manufacturing opportunities to Columbia County. I was also asked to take a look at some of the concerns. We have been, the Port Commission and the staff has been active, taking advantage of outreach opportunities, querying folks on our website survey, participating even full-time 5 days of the county fair to reach out to hear both support and concerns. They identified a range of things, from first responders to traffic congestion to detrimental economic impact. As a result of that, the port coordinated and supported a trip with a number of folks, citizens, some mayors, or invited some mayors, first responders, and port personnel to a coal community back east in Newport News, Virginia. From there, we had the opportunity to meet with the Chamber of Commerce, the city manager there, neighboring break bulk terminal, the terminal itself at Kinder Morgan, first responders, both on the maritime side as well as the shore side, the river pilots on the Virginia and Maryland side, as well as the captain of the port to talk about safety, security, and other maritime environmental concerns. What we found was that in that very urban area, dealing with a great deal of trains and a great deal of coal through three different coal terminals, is that the impacts that were brought up seem to be extremely minimal or non-existent for some of those issues that were brought up. First responders didn't have an issue. Captain Laporte from environmental and the maritime side wasn't an issue. Chamber of Commerce said by no means did it detract and drive away business. Many of these was good to hear. And including that trip, we had some a local city manager, we had a first responder with us, and a number of others. So the bottom line is there will be some rail challenges, without a doubt. But those rail challenges will exist through Columbia County, irrespective of the commodity that the cars are carrying. And those are things that will have to be addressed. And the port is committed to working with the railroad and the communities to work on those issues, to identify if there's safety, to address it. If there's other things for capacity, to start working on that as soon as we can. Again, for the effort of time, I'll pass it on to my neighbor David here, but I'd be happy to answer your questions from the Port of St. Helens when time comes.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, for the record, I'm David Kosh, the Chief Executive Officer for the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay, which is also the owner of the Coos Bay Rail Line. The port is working to develop new cargo opportunities in the Coos Bay Harbor, many of which are listed on the handout that you have before you, all for the purpose of revitalizing our regional economy. We are working with private sector developers to pursue the Coos Bay Bulk Terminal Project as well, with the primary commodity being the export of coal for international markets. The port is engaged in several projects designed to improve our deep water harbor, and we continue to raise the approximate $90 million that we need during the next 5 years to continue addressing the backlog of deferred maintenance that exists on the Coos Bay Rail Line. We've been successful with our partners in raising approximately $31 million of that total in state and federal funding for major repairs. However, we believe that it is unlikely that state and federal programs will provide the $60 million that's remaining as needed funds over the next 5 years. The proposed bulk terminal project, also known as Project Mainstay, will help us significantly by paying not only for that backlog of rail line repairs, but also by investing in additional capacity necessary to handle unit trains on our rail line. We cannot turn away a project that would infuse private investment in the rail line. Otherwise, our region faces further deterioration of the rail line. As you heard from the PNW on their Astoria line, they face similar problems. And if that continues to happen, we may, in fact, be forced to abandon it for good. For the port, the regional manufacturers served by the rail line and the communities that we serve, that is not much of a choice. Yet, some of you may recall 5 years ago when the Coos Bay Rail Line was shut down by a hedge fund that proposed to tear up the rails and sell it for scrap. Thousands of jobs were at stake in our region, and the port worked with private and public partners, including local, state, and federal agencies, to buy the rail line, and we are proud to report that freight rail service was restored 1 year ago this past October. The Coos Bay Rail Link now provides a connection again to the North American markets for 10 regional industrial employers, from bridge builders to wood products manufacturers to organic dairy farmers.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt. We do have your written testimony. If you could try to summarize in the interest of time.
And I am not reading all of it, but I will say that a couple of things that you want to note is that during construction of the new bulk terminal and the rail improvements, we'll be supporting nearly 1,400 new jobs in Coos County, adding $80 million in payroll to the Coos County region. During operations, we're going to have 500 permanent jobs with an average wage of $70,000 a year. Some things that I want to point out specific with the project and with respect to my colleague, Mr. Waldron, Amber Energy is not the innovator of enclosed coal storage terminal and loading technology. One of the partners that we are working with has been doing it for 20 years down in Long Beach, California, and they are still moving coal today through the west coast of the United States at that facility. They're actually moving coal through two facilities on the west coast of the United States. They innovated that technology nearly 20 years ago, and it works. I visited it. It's not just plans on a drawing. It actually is there. We will also require the use of best management practices to eliminate coal dust through the use of the spray-on surfactants, and we are confident that the covered coal car technology will be developed not only because of the dust benefits, suppression benefits, but also because of the fuel economy benefits that it provides for the trains on the return trip is empty. Our project, like all of the others, will require rigorous state and federal permitting with lots of public comment opportunity, lots of independent review by the agencies whose job it is to review those permits and ensure that we're meeting all of the environmental standards that are applicable. Finally, unique to our project, we are developing, as the owner of the rail line, a sustainable communities grant program that will be funded by a tariff on the unit train rail cars that move on the rail line. That can provide up to $1.5 million at full build-out for sustainability projects along the rail line and will help expand the green economy into the rural communities of Southwest Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions for these three witnesses? What's your best?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the tariff, explain the tariff.
Sure.
I'm going to wait for the council's memo on this, but maybe you can explain on that.
Well, as the owner of the rail line, we are in a unique position to be able to charge a tariff as a part of the unit train, the rate that is charged for the rail car movement on the rail line. And in working with the partners on this project, they have agreed to a $20 tariff on every loaded rail car moving down the line that would go into the Sustainable Communities Grant Program. Modeled a bit after the greenhouse gas emission reduction program that the Port of Long Beach has on cargo moving through their port.
So that's a negotiated matter, not the imposition of a tax.
That's correct. And it's similar to what you heard with the Port of Moro project and negotiated additional fees that they're paying to support the school system. This was a unique additional funding project that we identified as necessary for this line.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess. Thanks. Other ports, so there's other ports who have declined and made them public statements about rejecting coal exports. The Port of Portland, Port of Vancouver, saying that coal is a risky bulk mineral and doesn't really fit with the values of our community. What makes those decisions suitable for those ports, but makes us more comfortable that that we, other ports should be moving forward?
Chair Hunt and Bence, Representative Smith. I guess at the Port of Morrow, we've been basically involved in coal-related activities for the past 20-plus years, mm-hmm. and so we're familiar with the commodity, and it doesn't seem to be of major concern to our area, and it is a commodity move, and so that's probably more reflective of the region that we live in eastern Oregon, at least in Morrow County, and so we saw it as a commodity move and an opportunity to have some jobs.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bence, Representative Smith. For the Port of St. Helens, I apologize that I've only been there a couple years, so I can't go back for extensive time. But looking at what we had for our rural area, where the location is, some of my experience in seeing what's happened back in Virginia and the impacts that it had there, it on a dry bulk commodity here that really unregulated from the transportation side of the house that I haven't been able to identify. It appears that it was a commodity that needed to be put on the table and determine if this was something that was going to fit what we're doing in Columbia County and for the Port of St. Helens, and will work to help us start that tipping point and what we need to do for economic recovery, extreme tax increment, and as well as job opportunities. So that's what we're looking at, sir.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bence, Representative Smith, with all respect to our wealthier neighbors to the north along the Columbia River that have a greater portfolio of opportunities than we have down in Coos Bay, if we had the choice between a potash terminal and a coal terminal as the Port of Vancouver did, sure, we would have taken the easier option. If we had a choice between expanding grain terminal operations, which we have none, or building a coal terminal, we probably choose the easier option as well. In Coos Bay, we've seen shipping decline from 8.5 million tons of cargo per year to 1.5 million tons of cargo per year. We've seen over 300 deep draft vessel calls fall to nearly 25 vessel calls in 2009. We're on the ropes, and we've been there for a long time. This is the opportunity that's here. It's the opportunity that wants to make an investment in the community on the rail line, and we don't have the luxury of passing it up, waiting for something better to come along.
I hear that. Last question. So it sounds like 10% of the coal dust gets past the hairspray. That is what I heard in the last testimony. Do you know about how much 10% of that is, how much that means?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benson, Representative Smith.
The studies that I have reviewed on this, and I have personally reviewed many of the studies on the effectiveness of the surfactant, some of them will tell you that the surfactants that are used are actually 95 to 99% effective, and that all of the coal dust that you see coming off the rail cars is occurring in the first 100 to 500 miles of transit. Our facility is 1,700 miles away from the mine site. We don't anticipate any more than a few pounds at the most that might blow off any given year. The studies that have been done to look at the impacts on crops, for example, from that amount, finds that the material in the coal dust does not even register above the background levels of what you find in soils naturally in the area, so it is not an issue.
That's helpful. Thanks.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks for the information.
Move forward the mayors and Brent. Also, while they're coming forward, I recognize sitting in the audience is Representative Black Caddy McEwen, who also is a Port of Coos Bay commissioner, who's going to lend lots of expertise to the next legislative session on everything that's been on our agenda this morning. So, good to have you here. Former Representative Mayor Katie Piercy.
Thank you.
Welcome. Please begin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Benz. Thank you for the invitation to, and the rest of the committee as well. Thank you so much for the invitation to come and talk to you about our Eugene discussion about coal trains. And the first thing I wanted to say to you is that I'm currently serving on our local MPO. I chair the Lane County Act. I'm co-chairing the State Rail Committee from Portland to Eugene. And I'm on the Rail Plan Advisory Committee. So I have more than a strong interest, and I have more than strong support for rail, both freight and passenger, in the state of Oregon. And I also want to say that my city has been very supportive of the Coos Bay Line. When we first heard about the rail proposal and looked at the governor's request for an EIS and heard from our congressional delegation some concerns for some studies to be made. And then we heard from our folks from Washington, and we heard from our public in large number. We also received from our own City Sustainability Commission some recommendations, which were to direct the city manager and appropriate staff to identify all possible actions the city can take to prevent the transport of coal through Eugene. Pass a resolution or ordinance to oppose coal export from Coos Bay and transport through Eugene. Inform Governor Kitzhaber, the Port of Coos Bay officials, and coal companies involved in the proposal to transport coal through Eugene that the city will enforce all applicable local, state, and federal laws protecting public health, safety, and air and water quality to prevent the transport of coal through the city, and join other cities in Oregon to lobby the governor and legislature to oppose coal export terminals in the state of Oregon. This was a recommendation that came to our council from our Sustainability Commission. One of our councilors, Councilor Zelenka, brought forward a resolution, and in accordance with that recommendation from the our Sustainability Commission, and we of course heard from the Port of Coos Bay, and we heard from Representative Roblin, and we heard from Senator Verger, all deeply concerned about it. And so my recommendation to council was that let's not move on a resolution until you really fully hear from both sides of the issues. And so I put together a panel with two representatives pro coal train and two negative, and we had the port and Mayor Timchuk from Reedsport come on the pro side, and then on the anti side, well, on the anti coal train side, but pro resolution, we had people from Climate Solutions and from Physicians for Social Responsibility come and do a presentation to our council and to make give their best reasons for their position, and then council had a chance to ask questions and here are some of the concerns, because I know that's what you wanted to hear about. We're strong supporters of improved rail services in Oregon, but we're concerned that coal exports will worsen climate change and undermine city policies. Relying on coal exports is a risky business strategy, and local impacts are just unacceptable. Five other coal port projects are proposed in the Northwest. Combined, they would ship 80 million to 150 million tons of coal per year through Northwest cities. This is an enormous campaign. Burning this much coal would result in carbon dioxide emissions equivalent to those from all of the gasoline used each year in the entire western U.S. Unless we are successful in shifting from fossil fuels to clean energy, we face dangerous climate disruption, and that is an ethical question. Some say it's going to go regardless, so why don't we take advantage of it? But we consider that to be an ethical question. I think you might be interested to know that we've done some survey work in our community, and 77% of Eugenians think that climate change is real and human-caused. 71% believe that the long-term impacts will be catastrophic, and 78% think we need much stronger regulation of greenhouse gases. That is why we have the deep concern over the coal trains. The only other comment I want to make right now is that we spent a lot of time talking about a surfactant, and at least the last I heard, the coal industry and the train industry are in a legal battle over who should pay the $50 million to $150 million per year to apply a surfactant to the coal trains to prevent coal from flying off. So we don't even have an agreement on that. And so I guess I just will happy to answer any questions. Our resolution for your information that council voted in favor of goes like this. While we strongly support the use of rail on the Coos Bay rail link for freight and the resulting jobs at the port of Coos Bay, we find that coal trains through our city would have adverse social, economic, and environmental consequences for Eugene without much, if any, economic benefit to our community. Allowing coal trains to pass through our city is not compatible with the city's efforts to improve air quality, enhance public health, and promote local food production. Exporting coal to Asia for electricity production is inconsistent with Eugene's efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change, move toward a lower carbon future, and create clean energy jobs. The City of Eugene shall explore whether there are local, state, or federal laws protecting public health, safety, and air and water quality that can be used to prevent the transport of coal through the city, and if so, take reasonable steps to prevent this. We fully support Governor Kitzhaber's request that a federal agency prepare a programmatic and comprehensive environmental impact statement under the National Environmental Policy Act to look at the unprecedented number of coal export proposals pending in the Pacific Northwest, as well as the potential effects in this country of the use of coal in Asia. Now is the time for a programmatic EIS before substantial and irreversible commitments of resources are made. The City of Eugene joins the call for review of comprehensive independent health impact assessment before any permits are approved for any proposed coal export. This resolution was sent to Governor Kitzhaber, Senators Wyden and Merkley, Congressman DeFazio, Secretary of Interior Salazar, Secretary of Army McHugh, General Temple, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Director Abbey of the Bureau of Land Management, our local legislative delegation, and the city shall lobby on this behalf. So that's kind of wraps up what we've done in Eugene. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mayor Ferguson. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here today. I, too, serve on the Oregon Passenger Rail Leadership Council with Mayor.
Mayor, if you could just introduce yourself for the record,
please. Sorry. I'm Jeremy Ferguson, Mayor for the City of Milwaukee. Thank you for having me here this morning. As I mentioned, I, too, serve on the Oregon Passenger Rail Leadership Council with Mayor Piercy. And I think Milwaukee has a unique position in this rail alignment in that, as does Mayor Piercy and Eugene. Eugene is at the southernmost point, and Milwaukee's at the northernmost point of the transport of coal and other freight through the Willamette Valley Corridor. I provided two documents for your information this morning. One was a Milwaukee coal resolution process and timeline. I wanted to show you that Milwaukee took some considerable steps in reviewing coal transport before we came to a decision, a resolution in our city. That included meeting with the Port of Coos Bay twice, We took testimony from the building trades, and we also took testimony from Union Pacific, and we've met with Union Pacific. But we've also had a groundswell of support from our community. In fact, we had one meeting in which we had 85 residents turn out to talk about their concerns regarding coal trains. Now, I've been a supporter of other rail projects. In fact, I work for Portland Streetcar, and I've had 17 years experience in working for light rail in the past. So I'm not new to the rail industry. In fact, Milwaukee is receiving a little project called the Portland-Milwaukee Light Rail Project. Mm-hmm. So overall, our community has been supportive of rail projects. However, there's been great concern about the coal transport through our community. With 85 people turning out for the coal train issue, you can contrast that with the turnout of our light rail meetings, where we have about 20 to 25 community members, and not all of them oppose light rail when they turn out. So this timeline, it lists many of the things that I did to get to our resolution, but at the very bottom of this one-page document is the questions that most frequently came up in our community. So I would draw your attention to that. One of the things that I could spend some time talking about is how coal exports align with the city's vision and sustainability plan, but I think there's other folks here that are willing to tackle that. What I would like to focus some attention on is what benefits are provided to our community by allowing coal trains to come through our community, and what kind of research has been done to make sure that our community has been will be protected if coal trains come through our community. The city of Milwaukee draws its drinking water from the groundwater. In fact, the UP main line goes right over well number 7 in our community, which provides drinking water to about 1/4 of our population, and it also goes through a wetlands. We would like to see more research done on the surfactant technology, mm-hmm. as well as the containers themselves. We understand that there's potential for this Powder River Basin type coal, which is not like the lump coal that many of us politicians will get in our stocking this year, mm-hmm. But it's more of a crushed type of coal. It's very friable. We're concerned that coal dust and particles could escape the rail containers and then contaminate our groundwater or the dirt and soil surrounding the rail lines. I'm trying to summarize because I respect your timeline. So I would also just like to draw your attention to the resolution. It was actually modeled after Eugene's resolution, although we had some adjustments to meet our community's questions and expectations. And we recognize that these communities that are proposing export terminals are in dire need of economic development and jobs. So we specifically removed reference to a specific project, and we have had very good conversations with Coos Bay and support their projects. We just have significant concerns about coal transport. So like Eugene, we would encourage the state to have a health impact study as well as a comprehensive environmental impact study before we move forward with these projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee. My name is Brett Vandenhoevel, and I'm the director of Columbia Riverkeeper. We're a conservation group works to protect the Columbia River. I'm also here representing Power Pass Gold, which is a collection of over 100 organizations and businesses that have raised serious questions about coal export. I'm gonna... All right. We'll just start on this one then. There's tremendous public interest in this issue. This is a slide of a coal export terminal in South Africa. This is one of the largest in the world that exports about 60 million tons of coal per year. To put that in perspective, the proposal in Bellingham is 48 million tons. The proposal in Longview is 40. So slightly smaller but comparable in scale is this. I was at a DEQ hearing about coal export on Thursday night, and there was 850 people there. DEQ said it was the largest hearing they've ever had on an issue. The vast, vast majority, well over 90%, were opposed. Over 20,000 letters have been delivered to Department of State Lands and other state, Oregon state agencies raising questions about coal. Coal is dirty, you know, from when it's mined and transported on trains to these terminals to being burned everywhere along that supply chain. It's full of toxic materials that are harmful to our water and to our air. I would be remiss if I didn't mention our climate as well. I think that is the cause of a lot of concern of many people. If we take the Powder River Basin coal and send it to China to be burned in coal-fired power plants, we're going to see significant effects. I'm going to move quickly, but want to talk about address some of the comments that have been made already, and talk about the transportation and economic side of this. Almost every port has rejected coal export, other than the Port of Morrow, the Port of St. Helens, and Coos Bay, where these projects are. We did extensive public records request, and all up and down from Puget Sound throughout the Columbia. And there's interesting reasons. You know, I don't pretend to understand all of the reasons because we haven't seen them. But Port of Vancouver, some of the conversation said, coal market is the most risky bulk material. Consuming markets have no loyalty and will quickly shift to the cheapest market. Because it is a fickle market, there is real danger in losing investment, both in construction capital and lost opportunity in a poorly performing asset. So that was from Mike Schiller, the operations manager at the Port of Vancouver. We've seen similar statements from Port of Tacoma. Port of Portland said it's not consistent with our community. So we think there's real economic risk as well. Some of you likely remember what happened at the Port of Portland in the 80s. It was a lot of I went back and read all the magazine or the Oregonian articles. A lot of the very similar statements about this great market opportunity that ended up falling apart in years of litigation and lost assets. The coal trains. This is a coal train that derailed on the way to the gorge this summer. Obviously, they don't all derail, but it shows that they are uncovered. If you went up to Mesa, Washington today, you would still see coal on the ground. This is a quick chart of the proposals. We're looking at 100. These are not speculative, and there may be more to come, but this is what we have on the books, either existing lease options or permit applications. We have 140 million tons of coal proposed. If you calculate that into trains, that's 56 trains, both inbound and outbound, per day. Those trains would all, at least the inbound, go through the Columbia River Gorge and through either Portland or Vancouver. So it's a tremendous impact. If just for comparison, I believe UP runs about 30 trains per day right now. So we would see a significant increase in trains. There was a consultant named Whiteside and Associates looked at the economic impacts of the coal export, and I'll just summarize the report quickly. They concluded that, well, I would be best reading from the report very quickly, one sentence. They concluded that current railroad traffic in the Pacific Northwest, import and export, intermodal container traffic, and export grain traffic would be adversely impacted by the reduction of rail capacity from coal export. So they're looking at this very broadly and saying, and this is a long study, but container ships, container transport, and grain would be adversely affected by coal. That's something we want to have a very deep understanding of what those impacts and if they exist before moving forward with any of these projects. I know that the state of Oregon in some ways is hamstrung in the authority, but asking these questions is certainly within your ability. This is a map of the city of Portland. The red is the Burlington Northern line. The yellow is the UP line. There would be coal trains being transported along these lines through communities. Over 700 doctors in Washington, in Whatcom County alone, have raised concerns about the health impacts of coal. I believe over 200 in Oregon have as well. So this isn't just an environmental issue. This is very much a public health issue. The coal contains arsenic and mercury, lead. Coal dust does leave trains. This is a quote from Burlington Northern's website. The amount of coal dust that escapes Powder River Basin trains is surprisingly large. From 500 pounds to a ton of coal can escape from a single loaded car. From a single car, so at the low end of that, take 500 and multiply it by 100 to 125 cars per train, that's a lot of dust. I certainly agree, closer to the mine mouth, it's likely that more falls off, but we don't know. We don't know that. In the Columbia River Gorge, there is a significant amount of coal on the ground that people see that hits cars blowing off the trains. These surfactants have been in use already, and there's, as was mentioned, there's ongoing litigation. A lot of the shippers are refusing to use them. Burlington Northern is trying to force the coal companies to use them, and many of them have refused. The latest in litigation is calling it junk science. So that, there's ongoing debate of whether that could work. I was interested to hear from UP about whether that there could be hard toppers on top. That's the first time we've heard about that. This is an extreme slide. This is the Portland and Western line going through the A Street on Rainier, Oregon, in Rainier, Oregon. There would be 12 coal trains per day passing down the middle of this street. If you talk to the local businesses along that, several of them will tell you that it will destroy their business. Those trains would be up to a mile and a half long, 12 times per day, likely not traveling very quickly through here. Many other communities have at-grade crossings. If you think of going out Highway 30, Scappoose, St. Helens, Rainier have many at-grade crossings where there would be significant delay in traffic. And just, I'll wrap up with a couple comments about the barges. This is an Oregonian article noting that in a few years, coal could be the number one commodity supplanting wheat. Originally, Amber Energy noted in their barge traffic, in their environmental review document, the top quote is from them, that the I-5 bridge would need to be lifted twice a day during high water flows. They have since backed off of this. They got a call from a reporter, and now they have a different plan. But to me, I don't know. You know, certainly they say they can do it. We have to take that at face value. But it does raise questions of we should have an independent, full review of these issues that could have tremendous amount of impact on traffic through Portland and Vancouver. Those of you, well, the Columbia River crossing would fix this problem. But
let's do it.
We don't know when that's going to happen.
Sorry.
So I will close by saying I've never seen an issue galvanize the public like coal export. People in business, people in government at many levels, there's a very visceral reaction to exporting U.S. coal to Asia. There's also, as people have learned more about it, there's a very serious economic questions. There certainly would be an economic advantage of getting jobs, but would those be outweighed by all of the jobs that would be lost? Mechanisms of addressing that could be some questions by the legislature. Could also look at some of the environmental impacts in the environmental impact statements that are currently being done by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Amber Energy has a project that's probably the furthest along, this barge project. They also have a rail project right across the river in Longview, same company. And there's a real question of whether, you know, how those the rail and the trains would interact, and whether you know, they need to get coal to the ocean in some way, so whether they would switch to rail in the future. As was noted by Mr. Waldron, you know, Amber has very little experience. They've never built one of these. So we think that deserves even more questions as the first coal export terminal in Oregon.
If you could wrap up your testimony, we're
sure.
Over time.
I'll just end with that. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Representative
White. If I may, just real quick. Have you been to Boardman, Brett? Or any one of the three of you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you've seen the coal-fired plant there?
Yeah, I've done a tour of it.
Did you see anything there that concerned you?
Co-chairs Hunt, Benz, Representative Widener. Yes, absolutely. You know, there's coal out in piles. There are ways away from the Columbia River, but yeah, certainly coal and the coal-fired power plant itself is a concern. I think Oregonians have made the choice to move away from that fuel. But I could go along. I haven't done it that far east, but where I live in the Columbia River Gorge, I could take anyone out and find, you can find coal anywhere along the railroad tracks. Most of it is on the Washington side because those are the coal trains.
Oh, look. Sure. Have you been to Gillette, Wyoming?
I have not.
Will they mine the coal? Coal's naturally in our ground, and it's in the groundwater there. These people have been there forever drinking this water, and there has been no harm done to these people that live in these coal mining communities. So, and if you take do you drink wine by chance?
Moderately. In moderation.
In moderation.
If you do a sample on that wine, it's going to have arsenic in it. It's going to have all the chemicals that you said will be in that wine. So you're drinking it when you partake of a glass of wine. And these levels, I think, that we're going to see here are much lower than what you get in a glass of wine. So I would recommend you probably stop drinking wine, too, because that's where we're getting to in society if we're going to be concerned about these issues. And I'm being serious. Anybody in here drinks wine, if you're concerned about this stuff, you better stop, because you run a sample on that glass of wine, you're going to find a lot of contaminants in that. So that was my two cents.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So when I looked at this some months ago, my primary concern that seemed like a local fiduciary could care about, right, whether China or Asia should be using coal, maybe not. Somebody in the legislative chair has a right to think about it. It's a fair question. But was coal dust coming off trains? I wasn't as versed, I'm not as versed, with impacts of barges that are covered. I mean, the difference, as I understood it then, was with a train, you use the air spray because if you cover it with a hard cover, most cover technology would make that a traveling bomb. Right, I mean, you want air to be able to allow it to escape. So that's why they use the ice cream coating. But a barge, they've figured it out how you could have a covered barge and it could be safe. Can you help me understand what the risks are that we should be thinking, other than a bridge lift or whatever, the risks that we should be understanding barges, or is there a meaningful difference between the barge and train shipping options?
Representative Smith, I'm not sure I'm the best person to talk about the barges. I know that they, you know, it's not widely used. They haven't been used for transporting coal covered on the Columbia. So, but what the dangers of that are, I don't fully understand.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you all. Appreciate y'all being here. Thanks for
testimony. Thank you very much.
And I think our last panel is just down to one person because we lost John Mullins to the governor's press conference since we're over time, but I invite Rob Rich to come forward. Batting cleanup. And actually, in fact, Rob, if you could have a seat, just stay right there. We're going to take a motion while we still have the entire committee here just to make sure. I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee members. Colleagues, we have...
What's that? Committee bills.
Okay.
Let the record show.
Okay. So these are, we have before us three LC drafts that have been suggested for introduction as committee bills. I would remind us in this process that any vote to introduce any one of these is not any kind of a signal of support or opposition to the measure. It's just introducing it into the process. So would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Betts.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1212, dated October 3rd, 2012. LC 1737, dated December 6th, 2012. And LC 2119, dated October 23, 2012.
Co-Chair Bentz has moved that LCs 1212, 1737, and 2119 be introduced as committee bills. Discussion. Any objection? We have unanimity. Those will be introduced to committee bills, and the returning members of the committee will see those in a session coming soon to you. So we'll close the work session on that. Thank you for your patience, Rob, and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
You bet. Good morning. I'm Rob Rich with Shaver Transportation Company, Tug and Barge Line on the Columbia Snake River System. I'm here today in my capacity as the president of the Columbia River Towboat Association, and could use a little hats off to Jay, who was concerned about a little IT experience here, so I'll take a little assistance in getting my PowerPoint on here. I apologize for the delay.
That's not his.
Yeah,
he's going to close that one and open.
He's closed that one. His is done probably sitting on the desktop. Oh.
Yeah, that's where I was struggling a little there.
Okay.
Just that far right
one. Okay, there we go. And enter. Wrong one.
Oh,
so incorrect.
Pause the microphone.
Okay, so I'm Columbia River Towboat Association. So I'm this one right here. Okay, and how do I advance it?
Is it F5 to make it slides?
Yep.
And you're off.
And
all right.
Then you just...
that one? Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay. All right. Thank you very much for that that assistance, co-chairs Hunt and Vince when we turn, and the rest of the committee. I will quickly, in the appreciation of time that's been spent already, I will quickly in a few moments go through the short slide presentation that I have. But we did have some discussion a little earlier here with the previous panel concerning barges. And I thought I'd take an opportunity to just speak directly to the barges at this moment. What you see on the cover photo here is a nearly a full standard Columbia River barge tow. You'll notice three barges in that tow. Those happen to be grain barges, covered grain barges. The barges are constructed from their inception, from top to bottom, to be completely enclosed. These are not barges that have covers added to them that go on and off. The tops of the barges either slide open on little railroad tracks, per se, or they have spring-loaded hatches that open vertically. They have rain seals on them that keep the rain from going in, but they're not hermetically sealed. So there is some slight transfer of air in the barges. As most people are aware, grain is a fairly combustible product. Its dust is fairly combustible, and we do not have an issue with any kind of barging of grain as far as self-combustion or fires on the river in that concern. The grain barges that have been proposed proposed for the Morro Pacific project are designed directly from these Columbia River grain barge designs that are built here and sourced in our region. So I just wanted to get that out there for folks that may be interested there. Coal Initiative by Barge, speaking directly to the Morro Pacific project, the navigational infrastructure, specifically the dams, the navigation channel for barges and such. The existing system needs no additional investment. We do not need to add any capacity as far as infrastructure on the river system. The standard operation and maintenance budget that the Corps of Engineers utilizes each year to maintain our programs for lockages are plenty adequate. Plenty of available capacity. What does plenty mean? Currently, there are about 1,200 barge tows a year that are transiting through Bonneville Dam. At its peak in the late 90s, it was around 1,700 tows a year. So there's about a 450, 500 barge tow differential between the peak, which, by the way, was not the capacity of the system, but was certainly the busiest period of time. So there's plenty of room for that commodity on the river at this time. Supply chain flexibility with the barges. One of the things I wanted to point out, that when the barges are at their destination, either awaiting loading or awaiting discharge, they're tied off at barge moorages that are out of the channel. They're not taking up any other kind of infrastructure positioning. They don't supplant any other movement of cargo on the river. Environmental responsibility as far as the barge lines are concerned. The Texas Transportation Institute, along with MARAD, about 4 years ago, commissioned a study to update the ton-mile efficiencies of truck, rail, and barge. We've gotten to hear some great innovation on the part of rail as far as being nearly 500 miles per gallon of diesel on a ton-mile basis. The inland barge fleet, now this isn't specifically Columbia River, this is actually the entire country, 576 miles per gallon of diesel being the most efficient and lowest emission mode for transportation of bulk commodities. The current Columbia River tug fleet of all of the carriers that operate on a regular basis are nearly 50% repowered with Tier 2 engines. Morro Pacific's program would involve the construction of new tugs and new barges. Any new tugs and barges built in the United States, tugs specifically, would be powered with Tier 3, and I've noted here Tier 4 if available. In other words, if this project went on long enough before the tugs were produced, the EPA would have Tier 4 available engines for construction. And those have cut down emissions by about 90%. In our own fleet of tugs, it's a 33% savings in fuel. And a comment earlier about the business energy tax credit, one of the things that we're proud of, at least three of the barge lines on the river have had the opportunity to utilize the business energy tax credit to help clean up the Columbia River Gorge airshed with these new clean burn engines in its tugs. Real job creation. Tug and barge construction, as you've heard, would be sourced in the region here. Specifically, the barges, at least 20 of them, 5 of them at the Vigor Yard, I've heard, and 20 at Gunderson, both in downtown Portland. Heavy industrial producers of rail cars over at Gunderson and, of course, the Vigor Marine Shipyard. The tugs would either be built in the Columbia River here or as far north as the Puget Sound, but frankly, the Columbia River has been building more tugs the last 10 years than the Puget Sound has. Good-paying family wage jobs. We hear a lot about good-paying family wage jobs. What is a family wage job? On the river, the towboat deckhands, when you've got seniority, you're running, in other words, you're working full-time, you're running about $55,000 to $65,000 a year plus benefits, and the tugboat captains are in the $75,000 to $90,000 a year range. And we're looking at another 50 to 70 towboat captains and deckhands to be moving this product when it gets to full build-out. And finally, the positive ripple effect on the additional commerce to the Columbia River system. We were around 2,200 ships calling the Columbia River back in the 90s. We're around 1,500 ships a year. The ships are significantly larger now. So that's a very positive thing as far as the efficiency of freight movement. Well, that being said, there's still considerable capacity and ability of the lower river system for the ship traffic. All of this creates a significant ripple effect. It isn't just the barge lines. It's the steamship agents. It's the vessel operators. It's the pilots. It's the longshoremen linemen working at the terminals, the linesmen that are tying the ships up. There's a significant economic advantage to having more commerce on the Columbia Snake River system. Just had a final picture of a bulk ship being assisted into a berth. Any questions today?
Any questions for Rob? Or was it wider?
Sir. Actually, if I could, just real quick, have you ever had a tugboat lose all of its wheat in the river?
I've been on the river 35 years. If you took the, the quick answer, yes, one in 35 years. And there was some mighty happy sturgeon below John Day Dam. I could provide you some rough statistics after the meeting concerning the number of barge tows that transit over, say, a 20-year period and the incidence of losing a cargo. That's one that I'm aware of in 35 years.
And in the heyday, how many? You said there was 1,500?
As far as barge tows, locking down through Bonneville Dam, utilizing the Columbia Snake River system, about 1,700. I think the exact number is 3,560 lockages, but I'm assuming lockages to be upstream and downstream because it's a boomerang system. You go up, you come back. So I'm looking at around 1,700 barge tows back in the late 90s. And right now we're around 2,250 lockages, so I'm looking at that as around 1,100 or so barge tows at this point. 1,500 was the approximate number of ships calling the Columbia River, the lower Columbia.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here.
I want to thank you for this opportunity. My first time in front of a committee, you went awful easy.
All right. You did well. Well, thank you, committee. We are over time, but appreciate your time and participation, not just in this hearing, but throughout this whole interim. I think we've established that not only is Representative Bentz very actively pursuing taxes, but I think I heard a pro-CRC shout-out from Representative Smith.
Very excited about it.
And Representative Whitener encouraged people to stop drinking wine, so we've plowed all kinds of new ground here today.
More coal, less wine.
So thank you all. Is there anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair.
We're adjourned.